Big Jim said without turning around. If she won't go on her own, throw her out, and tell whoever's on the desk that he's fired. Marty Arsenal winced and passed a hand over his eyes. Big Jim escorted Andy into the chief's office and closed the door.
Is he charged? Julia asked Randolph. You can't charge him without a lawyer, you know. It isn't legal.
And although he still didn't look dangerous, only stunned, Pete Randolph said something that chilled her heart. Until the dome goes away, Julia, I guess legal is whatever we decide it is.
When were they killed? Tell me that much anyhow.
Well, it looks like the two girls were fur... The office door opened, and she had no doubt at all that Big Jim had been standing on the other side, listening. Andy was sitting behind what was now Randolph's desk, with his face in his hands.
Get her out, Big Jim snarled. I don't want to have to tell you again.
You can't hold him incommunicado, and you can't deny information to the people of this town, Julia shouted.
You're wrong on both counts, Big Jim said. Have you ever heard that saying, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem? Well, you're not solving anything by being here. You're a tiresome, nosy Parker. You always were, and if you don't leave, you're going to be arrested. Fair warning.
Fine, arrest me. Stick me in a cell downstairs.
She held out her hands with the wrists together as if for handcuffs. For one moment, she thought Jim Rennie was going to hit her. The desire to do so was clear on his face. Instead, he spoke to Pete Randolph.
For the last time, get this nosy Parker out of here. If she resists, throw her out.
And he slammed the door. Not meeting her eyes, and with his cheeks the color of freshly fired brick, Randolph took her arm. This time, Julia went. As she passed the duty desk, Marty Arsenal said, more in disconsolation than anger, Now, look, I lost my job to one of these thuds who don't know their asses from their elbows.
You won't lose your job, Martz, Randolph said. I can talk him around.
A moment later, she was outside, blinking in the sunlight.
So, Pete Freeman said, how'd that go?
22. Benny was the first to come out of it, and aside from being hot, his shirt was stuck to his less-than-heroic chest. He felt okay. He crawled to Nori and shook her. She opened her eyes and looked at him, dazed. Her hair was clumped to her sweaty cheeks.
What happened? She asked. I must have fallen asleep. I had a dream, only I can't remember what it was. It was bad, though. I know that.
Joe McClatchy rolled over and pushed himself to his knees.
Jojo?
Benny asked. He hadn't called his friend Jojo since fourth grade.
You okay?
Yeah, the pumpkins were on fire.
What pumpkins?
Joe shook his head. He couldn't remember. All he knew was that he wanted to grab some shade and drink the rest of his Snapple. Then he thought of the Geiger counter. He fished it out of the ditch and saw with relief that it was still working. They'd built these things tough in the 20th century, it seemed. He showed Benny the +200 reading and tried to show Nori, but she was looking up the slope of Black Ridge to the orchard at the top.
What's that?
She asked, and pointed. Joe initially saw nothing. Then, a bright purple light flashed out. It was almost too bright to look at. Shortly thereafter, it flashed again. He looked down at his watch, wanting to time the flashes, but his watch had stopped at 4:02.
I think that's what we're looking for, he said, getting to his feet.
He expected his legs to feel rubbery, but they didn't. Except for being too hot, he felt pretty much okay.
Now, let's get the hell out of here before it makes us sterile or something.
Dude, Benny said, who wants kids? They might turn out like me.
Nevertheless, he mounted his bike. They rode back the way they came, not stopping to rest and drink until they were over the bridge and back to Route 119. Salt. 1. The female officers standing by Big Jim's H3 were still talking, Jackie now nervously puffing a cigarette, but they broke off as Julia Shumway stalked past them.
Julia, Linda asked hesitantly, what did...
Julia kept on. The last thing she wanted while she was still boiling was to talk to any more representatives of law and order as it now seemed to exist in Chester's Mill. She walked halfway to the Democrat's office before she realized that anger wasn't all she was feeling. It wasn't even most of what she was feeling. She stopped under the awning of Mill New and Used Books, closed until further notice, read the hand-lettered sign in the window. Partly to wait for her racing heart to slow, mostly to look inside herself. It didn't take long.
"Mostly. I'm just scared," she said,
and jumped a little at the sound of her own voice. She hadn't meant to speak aloud. Pete Freeman caught up with her. "Are you all right?"
"Fine."
It was a lie, but it emerged stoutly enough. Of course she couldn't tell what her face was saying. She reached up and tried to flatten the sleep stack of hair at the back of her head. It went down, then sprang up again. Bedhead on top of everything else, she thought. Very nice, the finishing touch. "I thought Rennie was actually going to have our new chief arrest you," Pete said. He was big-eyed, and at that moment looked much younger than his 30-something years.
"I was hoping..." Julia framed an invisible headline with her hands. "Democrat reporter scores exclusive jailhouse interview with accused murderer."
"Julia, what's going on here? Aside from the dome, that is, did you see all those guys filling out forms? It was kind of scary."
"I saw it," Julia said, "and I intend to write about it. I intend to write about all this. And at town meeting on Thursday night, I don't think I'll be the only one with serious questions for James Rennie."
She laid a hand on Pete's arm.
"I'm going to see what I can find out about these murders, then I'll write what I have, plus an editorial as strong as I can make it without rabble-rousing."
She uttered a humorless bark of laughter.
"When it comes to rousing rabble, Jim Rennie's got the home court advantage."
"I don't understand what you..."
"That's okay, just get busy. I need a couple of minutes to get hold of myself. Then maybe I can figure out who to talk to first. Because there isn't a hell of a lot of time. If we're going to go to press tonight..."
"Photocopier," he said.
"Huh?"
"Go to photocopier tonight." She gave him a shaky smile and shooed him on his way. At the door to the newspaper office, he looked back. She tossed him a wave to show she was okay, then peered through the dusty window of the bookstore. The downtown movie theater had been shut for half a decade, and the drive-in outside of town was long gone. Rennie's auxiliary car lot stood where its big screen had once towered over 119. But somehow, Ray Toll had kept this dirty little emporium galorium crutching along. Part of the window display consisted of self-help books. The rest of the window was heaped with paperbacks featuring fog-bound mansions, ladies in distress, and bare-chested hunks, both afoot and on horseback. Several of said hunks were waving swords, and appeared to be dressed in just their underpants. "Get the hots for dark plots," the sign on this side read. Dark plots, indeed. If the dome wasn't bad enough, weird enough, there's the selectmen from hell. What worried her the most, she realized, what scared her the most, was how fast this was happening. Rennie had gotten used to being the biggest, meanest rooster in the farmyard, and she would have expected him to try to strengthen his hold on the town eventually, say after a week or a month, cut off from the outside world. But this was only 3 days and change. Suppose Cox and his scientists cracked through the dome tonight. Suppose it even disappeared on its own. Big Jim would immediately shrink back to his former size. Only he'd have egg on his face, too.
What egg? She asked herself, still looking into the dark plots. He'd just say he was doing the best he could under trying circumstances, and they'd believe him.
That was probably true. But it still didn't explain why the man hadn't waited to make his move.
Because something went wrong, and he had to. Also, I don't think he's completely sane, she told the heaped-up paperbacks. I don't think he ever was.
Even if true, how did you explain people who still had fully stocked pantries rioting at the local supermarket? It made no sense unless
he instigated it.
That was ridiculous. The blue plate special at the paranoid cafe, wasn't it? She supposed she could ask some of the people who'd been at Food City what they'd seen, but weren't the murders more important?
She was the only real reporter she had, after all, and... Julia, Miss Shumway.
Julia was so deep in thought she almost lifted out of her loafers. She wheeled around and might have fallen if Jackie Weddington hadn't steadied her. Linda Everett was with her, and it was she who had spoken. They both looked scared.
Can we talk to you? Jackie asked.
Of course. Listening to people talk is what I do. The downside is that I write what they say. You ladies know that, don't you?
But you can't use our names,
Linda said. If you don't agree to that, forget the whole thing. As far as I'm concerned, Julia said, smiling, you two are just a source close to the investigation. Does that work?
If you promise to answer our questions, too, Jackie said, will you?
All right.
You were at the supermarket, weren't you? Linda asked.
Curiouser and curiouser.
Yes, so were you two, so let's talk. Compare notes.
Not here, Linda said. Not on the street, it's too public. And not at the newspaper office, either.
Take it easy, Lynn, Jackie said, putting a hand on her shoulder.
You take it easy, Linda said. You're not the one with the husband who thinks you just helped railroad an innocent man.
I don't have a husband, Jackie said, quite reasonably, Julia thought, and lucky for her. Husbands were so often a complicating factor.
But I do know a place we can go. It's private and always unlocked. She considered.
At least it was. Since the dome, I don't know.
Julia, who had just been considering whom to interview first, had no intention of letting these two slip away.
Come on, she said. We'll walk on opposite sides of the street until we're past the police station, shall we?
At this, Linda managed a smile.
What a good idea, she said.
2. Piper Libby lowered herself carefully in front of the altar of the First Congo Church, wincing, even though she had put down a pew pad for her bruised and swollen knees. She braced herself with her right hand, holding her recently dislocated left arm against her side. It seemed okay. Less painful than her knees, in fact. But she had no intention of testing it unnecessarily. It would be all too easy to get it out of joint again. She'd been informed of that, sternly, after her soccer injury in high school. She folded her hands and closed her eyes. Immediately, her tongue went to the hole where there had been a tooth up until yesterday. But there was a worse hole in her life.
Hello, not there, she said. It's me again, back for another helping of your love and mercy.
A tear trickled from beneath one swollen eyelid and ran down one swollen, not to mention colorful, cheek.
Is my dog anywhere around? I only asked because I miss him so much. If he is, I hope you'll give him the spiritual equivalent of a chew bone. He deserves one.
More tears now. Slow and hot and stinging.
Probably he's not. Most major religions agree that dogs don't go to heaven, although certain offshoot sects, and the Reader's Digest, I believe, disagree.
Of course, if there was no heaven, the question was moot. And the idea of this heavenless existence, this heavenless cosmology, was where what remained of her faith seemed more and more at home. Maybe oblivion. Maybe something worse. A vast, trackless plain under a white sky, say. A place where none was always the hour, nowhere the destination, and nobody your companions. Just a big old not there, in other words. For bad cops, lady preachers, kids who accidentally shot themselves, and galoot German shepherds who died trying to protect their mistresses. No being to sort the wheat from the chaff. There was something histrionic about praying to such a concept, if not downright blasphemous, but occasionally it helped.
But heaven's not the point, she resumed. The point right now is trying to figure out how much of what happened to Clover was my fault. I know I have to own some of it. My temper got the best of me. Again, my religious teaching suggests you put that short fuse in me to begin with, and it's my job to deal with it, but I hate that idea. I don't completely reject it, but I hate it. It makes me think of how when you take your car to get repaired, the guys in the shop always find a way to blame the problem on you. You ran it too much. You didn't run it enough. You forgot to release the handbrake. You forgot to close your windows, and the rain got in the wiring. And you know what's worse? If you're not there, I can't shove even a little of the blame off on you. What does that leave? Fucking genetics?
She sighed.
Sorry about the profanity. Why don't you just pretend it wasn't there? That's what my mother always used to do. In the meantime, I have another question. What do I do now? This town is in terrible trouble, and I'd like to do something to help, only I can't decide what. I feel foolish and weak and confused. I suppose if I was one of those Old Testament Eremites, I'd say I need a sign. At this point, even yield or reduce speed in school zone would look good.
The moment she finished saying this, the outside door opened, then boomed shut. Piper looked over her shoulder, half expecting to see an angel complete with wings and blazing white robe. If he wants to wrestle, he'll have to heal my arm first, she thought. It wasn't an angel. It was Romy Burpee. Half his shirt was untucked, hanging down his leg almost to mid-thigh, and he looked almost as downcast as she felt. He started down the center aisle, then saw her and stopped, as surprised to see Piper as she was him.
Oh, she, he said, only with his Lewiston on Parl accent. I'm sorry, I didn't know you was there. I'll come back later.
No, she said, and struggled to her feet once more, using just her right arm. I'm done, anyway.
I'm actually a Catholic, he said.
No shit, Piper thought.
But there isn't a Catholic church in the mill, which of course you know, being a minister, and you know what they say about any port in a storm. I thought I'd come in and say a little prayer for Brenda. I always liked that woman.
He rubbed a hand up one cheek. The rasp of his palm on the beard stubble there seemed very loud in the hollow silence of the church. His Elvis dew was drooping around his ears.
Loved her, really. I never said, but I think she knew.
Piper stared at him with growing horror. She hadn't been out of the parsonage all day, and although she knew about what had happened at Food City, several of her parishioners had called her, she had heard nothing about Brenda Perkins.
Brenda? What happened to her?
Murdered. Others, too. They saying that guy Bobby did it. He's been arrested.
Piper clapped a hand over her mouth and swayed on her feet. Romy hurried forward and put a steadying arm around her waist. And that was how they were standing before the altar, almost like a man and woman about to be married, when the vestibule door opened again and Jackie led Linda and Julia inside.
Maybe this isn't such a good place after all, Jackie said.
The church was a soundbox, and although she didn't speak loudly, Piper and Romeo Burpee heard her perfectly.
Don't leave, Piper said. Not if it's about what happened. I can't believe Mr. Barbara. I would have said he was incapable. He put my arm back in after it was dislocated. He was very gentle about it.
She paused to think about that.
As gentle as he could be, under the circumstances. Come down front, please, come down front.
People can fix a dislocated arm and still be capable of murder, Linda said, but she was biting her lip and twisting her wedding ring.
Jackie put a hand on her wrist.
We were going to keep this quiet, Lynn, remember?
Too late for that, Linda said. They've seen us with Julia. If she writes a story, and those two say they saw us with her, we'll get blamed.
Piper had no clear idea what Linda was talking about, but she got the general gist. She raised her right arm and swept it around.
You're in my church, Mrs. Everett, and what's said here stays here. Do you promise? Linda asked. Yes. So why don't we talk about it? I was just praying for a sign. And here you all are. I don't believe in stuff like that, Jackie said. Neither do I, actually, Piper said, and laughed. I don't like it, Jackie said. It was Julia she was addressing. No matter what she says, this is too many people. Losing my job like Marty is one thing. I could deal with that. The pay sucks anyway. Getting Jim Rennie mad at me, though. She shook her head. Not a good idea. It isn't too many, Piper said. It's just the right number. Mr. Burpee, can you keep a secret?
Romy Burpee, who had done any number of questionable deals in his time, nodded and put a finger over his lips.
Mum's the word, he said.
Let's go in the parsonage, Piper said.
When she saw that Jackie still looked doubtful, Piper held out her left hand to her, very carefully.
Come, let us reason together, maybe over a little tot of whiskey.
And with this, Jackie was at last convinced. 3.
31 burn, cleanse, burn, cleanse. The beast will be cast into a burning lake of fire. Revelations 19:20. To be tormented day and night forever. 2010. Burn the wicked. Purify the saintly. Burn, cleanse, burn, cleanse, 31. 31 Jesus of fire coming, 31.
The three men crammed into the cab of the rumbling public works truck looked at this cryptic message with some wonder. It had been painted on the storage building behind the WCIK studios, black on red, and in letters so large they covered almost the entire surface. The man in the middle was Roger Killian, the chicken farmer with the bullet-headed brood. He turned to Stuart Bowie, who was behind the wheel of the truck.
"What's it mean, Stuart?"
It was Fern Bowie who answered.
"It means that goddamn Phil Bush is crazier than ever. That's what it means."
He opened the truck's glove compartment, removed a pair of greasy work gloves, and revealed a .38 revolver. He checked the loads, then snapped the cylinder back into place with a flick of his wrist and jammed the pistol into his belt.
"And all funny," Stuart said. "That is a goddamn good way to blow your baby makers off."
"Don't you worry about me, worry about him," Fern said, pointing back at the studio.
From it, the faint sound of gospel music drifted to them.
"He's been getting high on his own supply for most of a year now, and he's about as reliable as nitroglycerin."
"Phil likes people to call him the chef now," Roger Killian said.
They had first pulled up outside the studio, and Stuart had honked the PW truck's big horn, not once, but several times. Phil Bushy had not come out. He might be in there, hiding. He might be wandering in the woods behind the station. It was even possible, Stuart thought, that he was in the lab. Paranoid, dangerous, which still didn't make the gun a good idea. He leaned over, plucked it from Fern's belt, and tucked it under the driver's seat.
"Hey!"
Fern cried.
"You're not firing a gun in there," Stuart said. "You're apt to blow us all to the moon."
And to Roger, he said, "When's the last time you saw that scrawny motherfucker?" Roger mulled it over.
"Been 4 weeks, at least, since the last big shipment out of town, when we had that big Chinook helicopter come in."
Stuart considered. Not good. If Bushy was in the woods, that was all right. If he was cowering in the studio, paranoid and thinking they were feds, probably still no problem. Unless he decided to come out shooting, that was. If he was in the storage building, though, that might be a problem. Stuart said to his brother,
"There's some good-sized chunks of wood in the back of the truck. Get you one of those. If Phil shows and starts cutting up rough, clock him one."
"What if he has a gun?" Roger asked quite reasonably.
"He won't," Stuart said.
And although he wasn't actually sure of this, he had his orders. 2 tanks of propane to be delivered to the hospital post-haste. "And we're going to move the rest of it out of there as soon as we can," Big Jim had said. "We're officially out of the meth business." That was something of a relief. When they were shut of this dumb thing, Stuart intended to get out of the funeral business, too. Move someplace warm like Jamaica or Barbados. He never wanted to see another dead body.
But he didn't want to be the one who told Chef Bushy they were closing down. Annie had informed Big Jim of that.
"Let me worry about the chef," Big Jim had said.
Stuart drove the big orange truck around the building and backed it up to the rear doors. He left the engine idling to run the winch and the hoist.
"Look at that," Roger Killian marveled.
He was staring into the west where the sun was going down in a troubling red smear. Soon, it would sink below the great black smudge left by the woods fire and be blotted out in a dirty eclipse.
"Don't that just beat the dickens?"
"Quit gawking," Stuart said. "I want to do this and get gone. Fernie, get you a junk. Pick out a good one."
Fern climbed over the hoist and picked out a leftover piece of planking about as long as a baseball bat. He held it in both hands and gave it an experimental swish.
"This'll do," he said.
"Baskin Robbins," Roger said dreamily.
He was still shading his eyes and squinting west. The squint was not a good look for him. It made him resemble a fairy tale troll. Stuart paused while unlocking the back door, a complicated process that involved a touchpad and 2 locks.
"What are you pissing about?"
31 flavors, Roger said.
He smiled, revealing a rotting set of teeth that had never been visited by Joe Boxer or probably any dentist. Stuart had no idea what Roger was talking about, but his brother did.
"Don't think that's an ice cream ad on the side of the building," Fern said, unless there's Baskin Robbins in the Book of Revelations. Shut up, both of you, Stewart said. Fernie, stand ready with that junk.
He pushed the door open and peered in.
Phil, call him Sheriff, Roger advised, like that nigger cook on South Park. That's what he likes. Sheriff, Stewart called. You in there, Sheriff?
No answer. Stewart fumbled into the gloom, half expecting his hand to be seized at any moment, and found the light switch. He turned it on, revealing a room that stretched about three-quarters the length of the storage building. The walls were unfinished bare wood, the spaces between the laths stuffed with pink foam insulation. The room was almost filled with LP gas tanks and canisters of all sizes and brands. He had no idea how many there were in all, but if forced to guess, he would have said between 400 and 600. Stewart walked slowly up the center aisle, peering at the stenciling on the tanks. Big Jim had told him exactly which ones to take, had said they'd be near the back, and by God, they were. He stopped at the 5 municipal-sized tanks with CRHOSP on the side. They were between tanks that had been filched from the post office, and some with Mill Middle School on the sides.
We're supposed to take 2, he said to Roger. Bring the chain and we'll hook 'em up. Fernie, go you down there and try that door to the lab. If it ain't locked, lock it.
He tossed Fern his key ring. Fern could have done without this chore, but he was an obedient brother. He walked down the aisle between the piles of propane tanks. They ended 10 feet from the door, and the door, he saw with a sinking heart, was standing ajar. Behind him he heard the clank of the chain, then the whine of the winch and the low clatter of the first tank being dragged back to the truck. It sounded far away, especially when he imagined the chef crouching on the other side of that door, red-eyed and crazy, all smoked up and toting a Tech 9.
Chef, he asked, you here, buddy?
No answer. And although he had no business doing so, was probably crazy himself for doing so, curiosity got the better of him, and he used his makeshift club to push open the door. The fluorescents in the lab were on, but otherwise this part of the Christ is King storage building looked empty. The 20 or so cookers, big electric grills, each hooked to its own exhaust fan and propane canister, were off. The pots, beakers, and expensive flasks were all on their shelves. The place stank. Always had, always would, Fern thought. But the floor was swept, and there was no sign of disarray. On one wall was a Rennie's used cars calendar, still turned to August. Probably when the motherfucker finished losing touch with reality, Fern thought. Just floated away. He ventured a little further into the lab. It had made them all rich men, but he had never liked it. It smelled too much like the funeral parlor's downstairs prep room. One corner had been partitioned off with a heavy steel panel. There was a door in the middle of it. This, Fern knew, was where the chef's product was stored. Long glass crystal meth put up not in gallon baggies, but in hefty garbage bags. Not shit glass, either. No tweaker scruffing the streets of New York or Los Angeles in search of a fix would have been able to credit such stocks. When the place was full, it held enough to supply the entire United States for months, perhaps even a year. Why did Big Jim let him make so fucking much? Fern wondered. And why did we go along? What were we thinking of? He could come up with no answer to this question but the obvious one. Because they could. The combination of Bushy's genius and all those cheap Chinese ingredients had intoxicated them. Also, it funded the CIK Corporation, which was doing God's work all up and down the East Coast. When anyone questioned, Big Jim always pointed this out. And he would quote scripture, for the laborer is worthy of his hire, Gospel of Luke, and thou shalt not muzzle the ox while he is threshing, 1 Timothy. Fern had never really gotten that one about the oxes.
Chef,
advancing in a little farther still.
Good buddy.
Nothing. He looked up and saw galleries of bare wood running along two sides of the building. These were being used for storage, and the contents of the cartons stacked there would have interested the FBI, the FDA, and the ATF a great deal. No one was up there, but Fern spied something he thought was new. white cord running along the railings of both galleries, affixed to the wood by heavy staples. An electrical cord? Running to what? Had that nutball put more cookers up there? If so, Fern didn't see them. The cord looked too thick to be powering just a simple appliance like a TV or a
Fern! Stuart cried, making him jump. If he ain't there, come on and help us. I want to get out of here. They said there's going to be an update on TV at 6, and I want to see if they've figured anything out.
In Chester's Mill, they had more and more come to mean anything or anyone in the world beyond the town's borders. Fern went, not looking over the door and thus not seeing what the new electrical cords were attached to. A large brick of white clay-like stuff sitting on its own little shelf. It was explosive. The chef's own recipe. 4. As they drove back toward town, Roger said,
Halloween. That's a 31, too.
You're a regular fund of information, Stuart said.
Roger tapped the side of his unfortunately shaped head.
I store it up, he said. I don't do it on purpose. It's just a knack.
Stuart thought Jamaica or Barbados, somewhere warm for sure. As soon as the dome lets go, I never want to see another Killian or anyone from this town.
There's also 31 cards in a deck, Roger said.
Fern stared at him.
What the fuck are you?
Just kidding with you,
Roger said, and burst into a terrifying shriek of laughter that hurt Stuart's head. They were coming up on the hospital now. Stuart saw a gray Ford Taurus pulling out of Catherine Russell.
Hey, that's Dr. Rusty, Fern said. Better be glad to get this stuff. Give him a toot, Stewie.
Stuart gave him a toot. 5. When the godless ones were gone, Chef Bushy finally let go of the garage door opener he'd been holding. He had been watching the Bowie brothers and Roger Killian from the window in the studio men's room. His thumb had been on the button the whole time they were in the storage barn, rummaging around in his stuff. If they had come out with product, he would have pushed the button and blown the whole works sky high.
It's in your hands, my Jesus, he had muttered. Like we used to say when we were kids, I don't wanna, but I will.
And Jesus handled it. Chef had a feeling he would when he heard George Dow and the gospel tones come over the sat feed, singing, God, how you care for me. And it was a true feeling, a true sign from above. They hadn't come for a long glass, but for two piddling tanks of LP. He watched them drive away, then shambled down the path between the back of the studio and the combination lab storage facility. It was his building now, his long glass. At least until Jesus came and took it all for his own. Maybe Halloween. Maybe earlier. It was a lot to think about, and thinking was easier these days when he was smoked up. Much easier. 6. Julia sipped her small tot of whiskey, making it last, but the women cops slugged theirs like heroes. It wasn't enough to make them drunk, but it loosened their tongues. Fact is, I'm horrified, Jackie Weddington said. She was looking down, playing with her empty juice glass, but when Piper offered her another splash, she shook her head. It never would have happened if Duke was still alive. That's what I keep coming back to. Even if he had reason to believe Barbara had murdered his wife, he would have followed due process. That's just how he was. And allowing the father of a victim to go down to the coop and confront the perp, never. Linda was nodding agreement. It makes me scared for what might happen to the guy. Also, if it could happen to Barbie, it could happen to anyone? Julia asked. Jackie nodded, biting her lips, playing with her glass. If something happened to him, I don't necessarily mean something balls to the wall like a lynching, just an accident in his cell. I'm not sure I could ever put on this uniform again. Linda's basic concern was simpler and more direct. Her husband believed Barbie innocent. In the heat of her fury and her revulsion at what they had found in the McCain pantry, she had rejected that idea. Barbie's dog tags had, after all, been in Angie McCain's gray and stiffening hand. But the more she thought about it, the more she worried, partly because she respected Rusty's judgment of things and always had, but also because of what Barbie had shouted just before Randolph had maced him. "Tell your husband to examine the bodies. He must examine the bodies." "And another thing," Jackie said, still spinning her glass. "You don't mace a prisoner just because he's yelling. We've had Saturday nights, especially after big games, when it sounded like the zoo at feeding time down there. You just let him yell. Eventually they get tired and go to sleep." Julia, meanwhile, was studying Linda. When Jackie had finished, Julia said, "Tell me again what Barbie said."
"He wanted Rusty to examine the bodies, especially Brenda Perkins. He said they wouldn't be at the hospital. He knew that. They're at Bowie's, and that's not right."
"Goddamn funny, all right, if they was murdered," Romeo said. "Sorry for cussing, Rev."
Piper waved this away.
"If he killed them, I can't understand why his most pressing concern would be having the bodies examined. On the other hand, if he didn't, maybe he thought a post-mortem would exonerate him."
"Brenda was the most recent victim," Julia said. "Is that right?"
"Yes," Jackie said. "She was in rigor, but not completely. At least, it didn't look to me like she was."
"She wasn't," Linda said. "And since rigor starts to set in about 3 hours after death, give or take, Brenda probably died between 4 and 8 a.m. I'd say closer to 8, but I'm no doctor."
She sighed and ran her hands through her hair.
"Rusty isn't either, of course, but he could have nailed down the TOD a lot closer if he'd been called in. No one did that, including me. I was just so freaked out. There was so much going on."
Jackie pushed her glass aside.
"Listen, Julia, you were with Barbara at the supermarket this morning, weren't you?"
"Yes."
"At a little past 9, that's when the riot started."
"Yes."
"Was he there first, or were you?"
"Because I don't know."
Julia couldn't remember, but her impression was that she had been there first. That Barbie had arrived later, shortly after Rose Twitchell and Anson Wheeler.
"We cooled it out," she said. "But he was the one who showed us how. Probably saved even more people from being seriously hurt."
"I can't square that with what you found in that pantry. Do you have any idea what the order of the deaths were, other than Brenda last?" "Angie and Dodie first," Jackie said. "Decomp was less advanced with Coggins, so he came later."
"Who found them?"
"Junior Rennie. He was suspicious because he saw Angie's car in the garage, but that's not important. Barbara's the important thing here. Are you sure he arrived after Rose and Ants? Because that doesn't look good."
"I am, because he wasn't in Rose's van. Just the two of them got out. So if we assume he wasn't busy killing people, then where would he..."
But that was obvious.
"Piper, can I use your phone?"
"Of course."
Julia briefly consulted the pamphlet-sized local phone book, then used Piper's cell to call the restaurant. Rose's greeting was curt.
"We're closed until further notice. Bunch of assholes arrested my cook."
"Rose, it's Julia Shumway."
"Oh, Julia."
Rose sounded only a shade less truculent.
"What do you want?"
"I'm trying to check out a possible alibi timeline for Barbie. Are you interested in helping?"
"You bet your ass. The idea that Barbie murdered those people is ridiculous. What do you want to know?"
"I want to know if he was at the restaurant when the riot started at Food City."
"Of course."
Rose sounded perplexed.
"Where else would he be right after breakfast?
When Anson and I left, he was scrubbing the grills."
7. The sun was going down, and as the shadows grew lengthened, Claire McClatchy grew more and more nervous. Finally, she went into the kitchen to do what she had been putting off, use her husband's cell phone, which he had forgotten to take on Saturday morning. He was always forgetting it, to call hers. She was terrified it would ring 4 times, and then she'd hear her own voice, all bright and chirrupy, recorded before the town she lived in became a prison with invisible bars.
"Hi, you reached Claire's voicemail. Please leave a message at the beep."
And what would she say? "Joey, call back if you're not dead." She reached for the buttons, then hesitated. Remember, if he doesn't answer the first time, it's because he's on his bike and can't get the phone out of his backpack before it goes to voicemail. He'll be ready when you call the second time, because he'll know it's you. But if she got voicemail the second time? And the third? Why had she ever let him go in the first place? She must have been mad. She closed her eyes and saw a picture of nightmare clarity. The telephone poles and storefronts of Main Street, plastered with photos of Joe, Benny, and Nori, looking like any kids you ever saw on a turnpike rest area bulletin board, where the captions always contained the words, "Last seen on." She opened her eyes and dialed quickly before she could lose her nerve. She was preparing her message. "I'm calling back in 10 seconds, and this time you better answer, mister." Anne was stunned when her son answered loud and clear, halfway through the first ring. "Mom! Hey, Mom!" Alive, and more than alive, bubbling over with excitement from the sound. "Where are you?" she tried to say, but at first she couldn't manage anything, not a single word. Her legs felt rubbery and elastic. She leaned against the wall to keep from falling on the floor. "Mom, you there?" In the background she heard the swish of a car, and Benny, faint but clear, hailing someone. "Dr. Rusty, yo, dude, whoa!" She was finally able to throw her voice in gear. "Yes, I am. Where are you?" "Top of town, Common Hill. I was going to call you because it's getting near dark, tell you not to worry, and it rang in my hand, surprised the heck out of me." Well, that put a spoke in the old parental scolding wheel, didn't it? Top of town, Common Hill. They'll be here in 10 minutes. Benny probably wanting another 3 pounds of food. Thank you, God. Nori was talking to Joe. It sounded like, "Tell her, tell her." Then her son was in her ear again, so loudly jubilant that she had to hold the receiver away from her ear a little bit. "Mom, I think we found it. I'm almost positive. It's in the orchard on top of Black Ridge." "Found what, Joey?" "I don't know for sure, but don't want to jump to conclusions, but probably the thing generating the dome. Almost gotta be. We saw a blinker, like the ones they put on radio towers to warn planes, only on the ground and purple instead of red. We didn't go close enough to see anything else. We passed out, all of us. When we woke up, we were okay, but it was starting to get late." "Passed out?" Claire almost screamed this. "What do you mean you passed out? Get home right now so I can look at you." "It's okay, Mom," Joe said soothingly. "It's like, you know how when people first touch the dome, they get a little shock, then they don't? I think it's like that. I think you pass out the first time, and then you're like, immunized. Good to go. That's what Nori thinks, too." "I don't care what she thinks or what you think, mister. You get home right now, so I can see you're all right, or I'm going to immunize your ass." "Okay, but we have to get in touch with that guy, Barbara. He's the one who thought of the Geiger counter in the first place, and boy, he was right on the money. We should get Dr. Rusty, too. He just drove by us. Benny tried to wave him down, but he didn't stop. We'll get him and Mr. Barbara to come to the house, okay? We have to figure out our next move." "Joe, Mr. Barbara is..." Claire stopped. Was she going to tell her son that Mr. Barbara, who some people had begun referring to as Colonel Barbara, had been arrested on multiple murder charges? "What?" Joe asked. "What about him?" The happy triumph in his voice had been replaced by anxiety. She supposed he could read her moods as well as she could read his. And he had clearly pinned a lot of hope on Barbara. Benny and Nori had too, probably. This wasn't news she could keep from them, much as she would have liked to. But she didn't have to give it to them on the phone. "Come home," she said. "We'll talk about it here. And Joe, I'm awfully proud of you." 8. Jimmy Saroy died late that afternoon, as Scarecrow Joe and his friends were tearing back toward town on their bikes. Rusty sat in the hall with his arm around Gina Buffalino and let her cry against his chest. There was a time when he would have felt exceedingly uncomfortable about sitting this way with a girl who was barely 17, but times had changed. You only had to look at this hallway, lit now with hissing Coleman lanterns instead of by fluorescents shining calmly down from the paneled ceiling, to know that times had changed. His hospital had become an arcade of shadows. "Not your fault," he said. "Not your fault, not mine, not even his. He didn't ask to have diabetes. Although God knew there were people who coexisted with it for years, people who took care of themselves. Jimmy, a semi-hermit who had lived by himself out on the God Creek Road, had not been one of those. When he had finally driven himself into the health center, last Thursday, this had been, he hadn't even been able to get out of his car, just kept honking until Ginny came out to see who it was and what was wrong. When Rusty got the old fellow's pants off, he had observed a flabby right leg that had turned a cold, dead blue. Even if everything had gone right with Jimmy, the nerve damage probably would have been irreversible.
Don't hurt at all, Doc,
Jimmy had assured Ron Haskell just before slipping into a coma. He had been in and out of consciousness ever since, the leg getting worse. Rusty putting off the amputation even though he knew it had to come if Jimmy were to have any chance at all. When the power went out, the IVs feeding antibiotics to Jimmy and two other patients continued to drip, but the flow meters stopped, making it impossible to fine-tune the amounts. Worse, Jimmy's cardiac monitor and respirator failed. Rusty disconnected the respirator, put a valve mask over the old man's face, and gave Gina a refresher course on how to use the Ambu bag. She was good with it, and very faithful. But around 6 o'clock, Jimmy had died anyway. Now she was inconsolable. She lifted her tear-streaked face from his chest and said,
"Did I give him too much, too little? Did I choke him and kill him?"
No, Jimmy was probably going to die anyway, and this way he spared a very nasty amputation.
"I don't think I can do this anymore," she said, beginning to weep again. "It's too scary. It's awful now."
Rusty didn't know how to respond to this, but he didn't have to.
"You'll be okay,"
a raspy, plugged-up voice said.
"You have to be, hon, because we need you."
It was Ginny Tomlinson, walking slowly up the hallway toward them. "You shouldn't be on your feet," Rusty said.
"Probably not," Ginny agreed,
and sat down on Gina's other side with a sigh of relief. Her taped nose and the adhesive strips running beneath her eyes made her look like a hockey goalie after a difficult game.
"But I'm back on duty just the same."
"Maybe tomorrow," Rusty began.
"No, now," she took Gina's hand, "and so are you, hon. Back in nursing school, this tough old RN had a saying, you can quit when the blood dries and the rodeo's over."
"What if I make a mistake?"
Gina whispered.
"Everybody does. The trick is to make as few as possible, and I'll help you. You and Harriet both. So, what do you say?"
Gina gazed doubtfully at Ginny's swollen face, the damage accented by an old pair of spectacles Ginny had found somewhere.
"Are you sure you're up to it, Mrs. Tomlinson?" "You help me, I help you. Gina and Ginny, the fighting females."
She raised her fist. Managing a little smile, Gina tapped Ginny's knuckles with her own. "That's all very hot shit and rah-rah," Rusty said, "but if you start to feel faint, find a bed and lie down for a while. Orders from Dr. Rusty." Ginny winced as the smile her lips were trying on pulled at the wings of her nose.
"Never mind a bed. I'll just hosey Ron Haskell's old couch in the lounge."
Rusty's cell phone rang. He waved the women away. They talked as they went, Gina with an arm around Ginny's waist.
"Hello, this is Eric," he said.
"This is Eric's wife," a subdued voice said. "She called to apologize to Eric."
Rusty walked into a vacant examining room and closed the door. "No apology necessary," he said, although he wasn't sure that was true. Heat of the moment, had they let him go? This seemed to him a perfectly reasonable question, given the Barbie he was coming to know.
"I'd rather not discuss it on the phone. Can you come to the house, honey? Please. We need to talk."
Rusty supposed he could, actually. He'd had one critical patient who had simplified his professional life considerably by dying, and while he was relieved to be on speaking terms again with the woman he loved, he didn't like the new caution he heard in her voice.
"I can," he said, "but not for long. Ginny's back on her feet, but if I don't monitor her, she'll overdo. Dinner?"
"Yes."
She sounded relieved. Rusty was glad.
"I'll thaw some of the chicken soup. We'd better eat as much of the frozen stuff as we can while we've still got the power to keep it good."
"One thing. Do you still think Barbie's guilty? Never mind what the rest of them think. Do you?"
A long pause. Then she said,
"We'll talk when you get here."
And with that, she was gone. Rusty was leaning with his butt propped against the examination table. He held the phone in his hand for a moment, then pressed the end button. There were many things he wasn't sure of just now. He felt like a man swimming in a sea of perplexity. But he felt sure of one thing. His wife thought somebody might be listening. But who? The Army? Homeland Security? Big Jim Rennie?
Ridiculous, Rusty said to the empty room. Then he went to find Twitch and tell him he was leaving the hospital for a little while. 9. Twitch agreed to keep an eye on Jenny and make sure she didn't overdo, but there was a quid pro quo. Rusty had to examine Henrietta Clavard, who had been injured during the supermarket melee, before leaving. What's wrong with her? Rusty asked, fearing the worst. Henrietta was strong and fit for an old lady, but 84 was 84. She says, and I quote, "One of those worthless Mercier sisters broke my goddamn ass." She thinks Carla Mercier, who's Venziano now.
Right, Rusty said, then murmured, apropos nothing. It's a small town, and we all support the team.
So is it? Is it what, Sensei?
Broken?
I don't know. She won't show it to me, she says. And I also, quote, "I will only expose my smithy riddles to a professional eye." They burst out laughing, trying to stifle the sounds. From beyond the closed door, an old lady's cracked and dolorous voice said,
"It's my ass that's broke, not my ears. I hear that."
Rusty and Twitch laughed harder. Twitch had gone an alarming shade of red. From behind the door, Henrietta said,
"If it was your ass, my buddies, you'd be laughing out the other side of your faces."
Rusty went in, still smiling. "I'm sorry, Mrs. Clavard." She was standing rather than sitting, and to his immense relief, she smiled herself.
"Nah," she said. "Something in this balls up has got to be funny. It might as well be me." She considered. "Besides, I was in there stealing with the rest of them. I probably deserved it."
10. Henrietta's ass turned out to be badly bruised, but not broken. A good thing, because a smashed coccyx was really nothing to laugh about. Rusty gave her a pain-deadening cream, confirmed that she had Advil at home, and sent her away, limping but satisfied. As satisfied anyway as a lady of her age and temperament was ever likely to get. On his second escape attempt, about 15 minutes after Linda's call, Harriet Bigelow stopped him just short of the door to the parking lot.
"Ginny says you should know Sammy Bushy's gone?"
"Gone where?" Rusty asked. This under the old grade school assumption that the only stupid question was the one you didn't ask.
"No one knows. She's just gone."
"Maybe she went down to Sweetbriar to see if they're serving dinner. I hope that's it. Because if she tries to walk all the way back to her place, she's apt to bust her stitches." Henrietta looked alarmed.
"Could she, like, bleed to death? Bleeding to death from your woo-woo. That would be bad."
Rusty had heard many terms for the vagina, but this one was new to him. "Probably not, but she could end up back here for an extended stay. What about her baby?" Harriet looked stricken. She was an earnest little thing who had a way of blinking distractedly behind the thick lenses of her glasses when she was nervous. The kind of girl, Rusty thought, who might treat herself to a mental breakdown about 15 years after graduating summa cum laude from Smith or Vassar.
"The baby! Oh my God, little Walter!"
She dashed down the hall before Rusty could stop her and came back looking relieved.
"Still here. He's not very lively, but that seems to be his nature."
"Then she'll probably be back. Whatever other problems she might have, she loves the kid, in an absent-minded sort of way."
"Huh?"
More furious blinking. "Never mind. I'll be back as soon as I can, Harry. Keep him flying."
"Keep what flying?"
Her eyelids now appeared on the verge of catching fire. Rusty almost said, "I mean, keep your pecker up." But that wasn't right either. In Harriet's terminology, a pecker was probably a wah-wah. "Keep busy," he said. Harriet was relieved.
"I can do that, Dr. Rusty, no prob."
Rusty turned to go, but now a man was standing there. Thin, not bad-looking once you got past that hooked nose. A lot of graying hair tied back in a ponytail. He looked a bit like the late Timothy Leary. Rusty was starting to wonder if he was going to get out of here after all.
"Can I help you, sir?"
"Actually, I was thinking that perhaps I could help you." He stuck out a bony hand. "Thurston Marshall. My partner and I were weekending at Chester Pond and got caught in this whatever it is."
"I'm sorry to hear that," Rusty said.
"The thing is, I have a bit of medical experience.
I was a conscientious objector during the Vietnam mess. Thought about going to Canada, but I had plans. Well, never mind. I registered as a CO and did 2 years as an orderly at a veterans hospital in Massachusetts. That was interesting.
Edith Norse Rogers?
The very one. My skills are probably a bit out of date, but...
Mr. Marshall, do I have a job for you?
11. As Rusty headed down 119, a horn blew. He checked his mirror and saw one of the town's public works trucks preparing to turn in at Catherine Russell Drive. It was hard to tell in the red light of the lowering sun, but he thought Stuart Bowie was behind the wheel. What he saw on second glance gladdened Rusty's heart. There appeared to be a couple of LP tanks in the bed of the truck. He'd worry about where they came from later, maybe even ask some questions, but for now, he was just relieved to know that soon the lights would be back on, the respirators and monitors online. Maybe not for the long haul, but he was in full one-day-at-a-time mode. At the top of Town Common Hill, he saw his old skateboarding patient, Benny Drake, and a couple of his friends. One was the McClatchy boy, who'd set up the live video feed of the missile strike. Benny waved and shouted, obviously wanting Rusty to stop and shoot the shit. Rusty waved back, but didn't slow. He was anxious to see Linda, also to hear what she had to say, of course, but mostly to see her, put his arms around her, and finish making up with her. 12. Barbie needed to take a piss, but held his water. He had done interrogations in Iraq and knew how it worked over there. He didn't know if it would be the same here just yet, but it might be. Things were moving very rapidly, and Big Jim had shown a ruthless ability to move with the times. Like most talented demagogues, he never underestimated his target audience's willingness to accept the absurd. Barbie was also very thirsty, and it didn't surprise him much when one of the new officers showed up with a glass of water in one hand and a sheet of paper with a pen clipped to it in the other. Yes, it was how these things went. How they went in Fallujah, Tikrit, Hilla, Mosul, and Baghdad. How they also now went in Chester's Mill, it seemed. The new officer was Junior Rennie.
Well, look at you, Junior said. Don't look quite so ready to beat guys up with your fancy army tricks right now.
He raised the hand holding the sheet of paper and rubbed his left temple with the tips of his fingers. The paper rattled.
You don't look so good yourself.
Junior dropped his hand.
I'm fine as rain.
Now that was odd, Barbie thought. Some people said right as rain, and some said fine as paint. But none, as far as he knew, said fine as rain. It probably meant nothing, but... Are you sure? Your eyes all red.
I'm fucking terrific, and I'm not here to discuss me.
Barbie, who knew why Junior was here, said, Is that water? Junior looked down at the glass as if he'd forgotten it.
Yeah. Chief said you might be thirsty. Thursday on a Tuesday, you know.
He laughed hard, as if this non sequitur was the wittiest thing to ever come out of his mouth.
Want it?
Yes, please. Junior held the glass out. Barbie reached for it. Junior pulled it back.
Of course. It was how these things went. Why'd you kill them? I'm curious. Barbie. Wouldn't Angie fuck you no more? Then, when you tried Dodie, you found out she was more into crack snacking than cock gobbling? Maybe Coggins saw something he wasn't supposed to. And Brenda got suspicious. Why not? She was a cop herself, you know. By injection.
Junior yodeled laughter, but underneath the humor there was nothing but black watchfulness and pain. Barbie was quite sure of it.
What? Nothing to say?
I said it. I'd like a drink. I'm thirsty.
Yep, I bet you are. That Mace is a bitch, isn't it?
I understand you saw service in Iraq. What was that like?
Hot.
Junior yodeled again. Some of the water in the glass spilled on his wrist. Were his hands shaking a little? And that inflamed left eye was leaking tears at the corner. Junior, what the hell's wrong with you? Migraine? Something else?
Did you kill anybody?
Only with my cooking. Junior smiled as if to say, good one, good one.
You weren't any cook over there, Barbie. You were a liaison officer. That was your job description anyway. My dad looked you up on the internet. There ain't a lot, but there's some. He thinks you were an interrogation guy. Maybe even a black ops guy. Were you like the Army's Jason Bourne?
Barbie said nothing.
Come on, did you kill anybody? Or should I ask, how many did you kill? Besides the ones you bagged here, I mean.
Barbie said nothing.
Boy, I bet this water is good. It came from the cooler upstairs. Chilly Willy.
Barbie said nothing.
You guys come back with all sorts of problems. At least that's what I read and see on TV.
Right or false?
True or wrong?
It isn't a migraine making him do that. At least not any migraine I ever heard of. Junior, how bad does your head hurt?
Doesn't hurt at all.
How long have you been having headaches?
Junior set the glass carefully down on the floor. He was wearing a sidearm this evening. He drew it and pointed it through the bars at Barbie. The barrel was trembling slightly.
Do you want to keep playing doctor?
Barbie looked at the gun. The gun wasn't in the script, he was quite sure. Big Jim had plans for him, and probably not nice ones, but they didn't include Dale Barbara being shot in a jail cell when anybody from upstairs could rush down and see that the cell door was still locked and the victim unarmed. But he didn't trust Junior to follow the script because Junior was ill.
No, he said, no doctoring.
Very sorry.
Yeah, you're sorry, all right. One sorry shack of sit.
But Junior seemed satisfied. He holstered the gun and picked up the glass of water again.
My theory is that you came back all fucked up from what you saw and did over there. You know, PTSS, STD, PMS, one of those. My theory is that you just snapped. That about right?
Barbie said nothing. Junior didn't seem very interested anyway. He handed the glass through the bars.
Take it. Take it.
Barbie reached for the glass, thinking it would be snatched away, but it wasn't. He tasted it. Not cold. And not drinkable, either.
Go on, Junior said. I only shook half a shaker in. You can deal with that, can't you? You salt your bread, don't you?
Barbie only looked at Junior.
You salt your bread? Do you salt it, motherfucker? Huh?
Barbie held the glass out through the bars.
Keep it, keep it, Junior said magnanimously. And take this, too.
He passed the paper and pen through the bars. Barbie took them and looked the paper over. It was pretty much what he'd expected. There was a place for him to sign his name at the bottom. He offered it back. Junior backed away in what was almost a dance step, smiling and shaking his head.
Keep that, too. My dad said you wouldn't sign it right away, but you think about it. And think about getting a glass of water with no salt in it, and some food. Big old cheeseburger in paradise. Maybe a Coke.
There's some cold in the fridge upstairs.
Wouldn't you like a nice cone, Cole?
Barbie said nothing.
You salt your bread? Go on, don't be shy. Do you, ass face?
Barbie said nothing.
You'll come around. When you get hungry enough and thirsty enough, you will. That's what my dad says, and he's usually right about those things.
Ta-ta, Barbie.
He started down the hall, then turned back.
You never should have put your hands on me, you know. That was your big mistake.
As he went up the stairs, Barbie observed that Junior was limping a tiny bit. Or dragging. That was it. Dragging to the left and pulling on the banister with his right hand to compensate. He wondered what Rusty Everett would think about such symptoms. He wondered if he'd ever get a chance to ask. Barbie considered the unsigned confession.
He would have liked to tear it up and scatter the pieces on the floor outside the cell, but that would be an unnecessary provocation. He was between the cat's claws now, and the best thing he could do was be still. He put the paper on the bunk and the pen on top of it. Then he picked up the glass of water, salt, seeded with salt. He could smell it. Which made him think about how Chester's Mill was now... Only, hadn't it already been this way? Even before the dome? Hadn't Big Jim and his friends been seeding the ground with salt for some time now? Barbie thought yes. He also thought that if he got out of this police station alive, it would be a miracle. Nonetheless, they were amateurs at this. They had forgotten the toilet. Probably none of them had ever been in a country where even a little ditch water could look good when you were carrying 90 pounds of equipment and the temperature was 46 Celsius. Barbie poured out the salt water in the corner of the cell. Then he pissed in the glass and set it under the bunk. Then he knelt in front of the toilet bowl like a man at his prayers and drank until he could feel his belly bulging. 13. Linda was sitting on the front steps when Rusty pulled up. In the backyard, Jackie Weddington was pushing the little Jays on the swings, and the girls were urging her to push harder and send them higher. Linda came to him with her arms out. She kissed his mouth, drew back to look at him, then kissed him again with her hands on his cheeks and her mouth open. He felt the brief, humid touch of her tongue and immediately began to get hard. She felt it and pressed against it. "Wow," he said, "we should fight in public more often. And if you don't stop that, we'll be doing something else in public."
"We'll do it, but not in public. First, do I need to say again that I'm sorry?"
"No."
She took his hand and led him back to the steps.
"Good. Because we've got stuff to talk about. Serious stuff."
He put his other hand over hers. "I'm listening." She told him about what had happened at the station. Julia being turned away after Andy Sanders had been allowed down to confront the prisoner. She told about going to the church so she and Jackie could talk to Julia in private, and the later conversation at the parsonage with Piper Libby and Romy Burpee added to the mix. When she told him about the beginning rigor they had observed in Brenda Perkins' body, Rusty's ears pricked up.
"Jackie," he called, "how sure are you about the rigor?"
"Pretty," she called back.
"Hi, Daddy," Judy called. "Me and Jenny's gonna loop the loop."
"No, you're not," Rusty called back,
and stood to blow kisses from the palms of his hands. Each girl caught one. When it came to kiss-catching, they were aces.
"What time did you see the bodies, Lynn?"
"Around 10:30, I think. The supermarket mess was long over."
"And if Jackie's right about the rigor just setting in, but we can't be absolutely sure of that, can we?"
"No. But listen, I talked with Rose Twitchell. Barbara got to Sweetbriar at 6:10. From then, until the bodies were discovered, he's alibied. So he would have had to kill her when? 5? 5:30? How likely is that, if rigor was just setting in 5 hours later?"
"Not likely, but not impossible. Rigor mortis is affected by all sorts of variables. The temperature of the body storage site, for one. How hot was it in that pantry?"
"Warm," she admitted, then crossed her arms over her breasts and cupped her shoulders. "Warm and smelly."
"See what I mean? Under those circumstances, he could have killed her someplace at 4 a.m., then taken her there and stuffed her into the..."
"I thought you were on his side."
"I am, and it's really not likely, because the pantry would have been much cooler at 4 in the morning. Why would he have been with Brenda at 4 in the morning anyway? What would the cops say, that he was boffing her? Even if older women, much older, were his thing, 3 days after her husband of 30-plus years was killed?"
"They'd say it wasn't consensual," she told him bleakly. "They'd say it was rape, same as they're already saying for those 2 girls.
"And Coggins?"
"If they're framing him, they'll think of something."
"Is Julia going to print all this?"
"She's going to write the story and raise some questions, but she'll hold back the stuff about rigor being in the early stages. Randolph might be too stupid to figure out where that information came from, but Rennie would know."
"It could still be dangerous," Rusty said. "If they muzzle her, she can't exactly go to the ACLU.
"I don't think she cares. She's mad as hell. She even thinks a supermarket riot might have been a setup."
Probably was, Rusty thought.
What he said was,
"Damn, I wish I'd seen those bodies."
"Maybe you still can."
"I know what you're thinking, hon, but you and Jackie could lose your jobs. Or worse, if this is Big Jim's way of getting rid of an annoying problem."
"We can't just leave it like this."
"Also, it might not do any good, probably wouldn't, if Brenda Perkins commenced rigor between 4 and 8. She's probably in full rigor by now, and there isn't much I can tell from the body. The Castle County M.E. might be able to, but he's as out of reach as the ACLU.
Maybe there's something else. Something about her corpse, or one of the others. You know that sign they have in some postmortem theaters? This is where the dead speak to the living?
Long shot. You know what would be better? If someone saw Brenda alive after Barbie reported to work at 5:50 this morning. That would put a hole in their boat too big to plug. Judy and Janelle, dressed in their pajamas, came flying up for hugs. Rusty did his duty in this regard. Jackie Weddington, following along behind them, heard Rusty's last comment and said,
"I'll ask around."
"But quietly," he said.
"You bet, and for the record, I'm still not entirely convinced. His dog tags were in Angie's hand."
"And he never noticed they were gone during the time between losing them and the bodies being found?"
"What bodies, Dad?"
Janie asked. He sighed.
"It's complex, honey, and not for little girls."
Her eyes said that was good. Her younger sister, meanwhile, had gone off to pick a few late flowers, but came back empty-handed.
"They're dying," she reported. "All brown and yucky at the edges."
"It's probably too warm for them," Linda said. And for a moment, Rusty thought she was going to cry.
He stepped into the breach. "You girls go in and brush your teeth. Get a little water from the jug on the counter. Janie, you're the designated water pourer. Now go." He turned back to the women, to Linda in particular. "You okay?"
"Yes, it's just that it keeps hitting me in different ways. I think those flowers have no business dying, and then I think none of this has any business happening in the first place."
They were silent for a moment thinking about this. Then Rusty spoke up. "We should wait and see if Randolph asks me to examine the bodies. If he does, I'll get my look without any risk of hot water for you two. If he doesn't, it tells us something."
"Meanwhile, Barbie's in jail," Linda said. "They could be trying to get a confession out of him right now."
"Suppose you flashed your badges and got me into the funeral parlor?" Rusty asked. "Further, suppose I found something that exonerates Barbie. Do you think they'd just say, 'Oh, shit, our bad,' and let him out? And then let him take over? Because that's what the government wants. It's all over town. Do you think Rennie would allow..." His cell phone went off. "These things are the worst invention ever," he said. But at least it wasn't the hospital.
"Mr. Everett?"
A woman. He knew the voice, but couldn't put a name to it. "Yes, but unless this is an emergency, I'm a little busy right now."
"I don't know if it's an emergency, but it's very, very important. And since Mr. Barbara, or Colonel Barbara, I guess, has been arrested, you're the one who has to deal with it."
"Mrs. McClatchy?"
"Yes, but Joe's the one you need to talk to. Here he is."
"Dr. Rusty?" The voice was urgent, almost breathless. "Hi, Joe, what is it?"
"I think we found the generator. Now, what are we supposed to do?"
The evening went dark so suddenly that all three of them gasped, and Linda seized Rusty's arm. But it was only the big smoke smudge on the western side of the dome. The sun had gone behind it.
"Where?" "Black Ridge."
"Was there radiation, son?"
"Knowing there must have been, how else had they found it?" "The last reading was +200, Joe said. "Not quite into the danger zone. What do we do?"
Rusty ran his free hand through his hair. Too much happening, too much, too fast. Especially for a small-town fixer-upper who had never considered himself much of a decision-maker, let alone a leader. "Nothing tonight. It's almost dark. We'll deal with this tomorrow. In the meantime, Joe, you have to make a promise. Keep quiet about this. You know, Benny and Nori know, and your mom knows. Keep it that way."
"Okay." Joe sounded subdued. "We have a lot to tell you, but I guess you can wait until tomorrow."
He took a breath.
"It's a little scary, isn't it?"
"Yes, son," Rusty agreed. "It's a little scary."
14. The man in charge of the mill's fate and fortunes was sitting in his study and eating a corned beef on rye in big snaffling bites when Junior came in. Earlier, Big Jim had caught a 45-minute power nap. Now he felt refreshed and once more ready for action. The surface of his desk was littered with sheets of yellow legal paper, notes he would later burn in the incinerator out back. Better safe than sorry. The study was lit with hissing Coleman lanterns that threw a bright white glare. God knew he had access to plenty of propane, enough to light the house and run the appliances for 50 years. But for now, the Colemans were better. When people passed by, he wanted them to see that bright white glare and know that Selectman Rennie wasn't getting any special perks, that Selectman Rennie was just like them, only more trustworthy. Junior was limping. His face was drawn.
He didn't confess.
Big Jim hadn't expected Barbara to confess so soon and ignored this.
What's wrong with you? You look peaky as hell. Another headache. But it's letting go now.
This was true, although it had been very bad during his conversation with Barbie. Those blue-gray eyes either saw too much or seemed to.
I know what you did to them in the pantry, they said. I know everything.
It had taken all his will not to pull the trigger of his gun after he'd drawn it, and darkened that damnable prying stare forever.
You're limping, too. That's because of those kids we found out by Chester Pond. I was carrying one of them around, and I think I pulled a muscle.
Are you sure that's all it is? You and Thibodeau have a job to do, and...
Big Jim looked at his watch. In about 3.5 hours, and you can't mess it up. It has to go off perfectly.
Why not as soon as it's dark?
Because the witch is putting her paper together there with her two little trolls, Freeman and the other one, the sports reporter who's always down on the Wildcats.
Tony Gay.
Yes, him. I don't particularly care about them being hurt, especially her.
Big Jim's upper lip lifted in his dog-like imitation smile. But there must not be any witnesses, no eyeball witnesses, I mean, what people hear.
That's a very different kettle of cod.
What do you want them to hear, Dad?
Are you sure you're up to this? Because I can send Frank with Carter instead.
No. I helped you with Coggins and I helped you with the old lady this morning and I deserve to do this.
Big Jim seemed to measure him. Then he nodded.
All right. But you must not be caught, or even seen.
Don't worry.
What do you want the ear witnesses to hear?
Big Jim told him. Big Jim told him everything. It was good, Junior thought. He had to admit it. His dear old dad didn't miss a trick. 15. When Junior went upstairs to rest his leg, Big Jim finished his sandwich, wiped the grease from his chin, then called Stuart Bowie's cell. He began with the question everybody asks when calling a cell phone.
Where are you?
Stuart said they were on their way to the funeral home for a drink. Knowing Big Jim's feelings about alcoholic beverages, he said this with a working man's defiance. I did my job, now let me take my pleasure.
That's all right, but make sure it's only the one. You aren't done for the night, Fern or Roger either.
Stuart protested strenuously. After he'd finished having his say, Big Jim went on.
I want the three of you at the middle school at 9:30. There'll be some new officers there, including Roger's boys, by the way. And I want you there, too.
An inspiration occurred.
In fact, I'm going to make you fellows sergeants in the Chester's Mill hometown security force.
Stuart reminded Big Jim he and Fern had 4 new corpses to deal with. In his strong Yankee accent, the word came out corpses.
Those folks from the McCains can wait, Big Jim said. They're dead. We've got an emergency situation on our hands here, in case you didn't notice. Until it's over, we've all got to pull our weight, do our bit, support the team, 9:30 at the middle school. But I've got something else for you to do first. Won't take long. Put Fern on.
Stuart asked why Big Jim wanted to talk to Fern, whom he regarded, with some justification, as the dumb brother.
None of your beeswax, just put him on.
Fern said hello. Big Jim didn't bother.
You used to be with the volunteers, didn't you, until they were disbanded?
Fern said he had indeed been with this unofficial adjunct to the Chester's Mill FD, not adding that he had quit a year before the Vols had been disbanded, after the selectmen recommended no money be allocated to them in the 2008 town budget. He also did not add that he found the volunteers' weekend fundraising activities were cutting into his drinking time. Big Jim said, I want you to go to the PD and get the keys to the FD, then see if those Indian pumps Burpee used yesterday are in the barn. I was told that was where he and the Perkins woman put them, and that better be right.
Fern said he believed the Indian pumps had come from Burpee's in the first place, which sort of made them Romy's property. The volunteers had had a few, but sold them on eBay when the outfit disbanded. They might have been his, but they aren't anymore, Big Jim said. For the duration of the crisis, they're town property. We'll do the same with anything else we need. It's for the good of everyone. And if Romeo Burpee thinks he's going to start up the Vols again, he's got another think coming.
Fern said, cautiously, that he'd heard Romy did a pretty good job putting out the contact fire on Little Bitch after the missiles hit.
That wasn't much more than cigarette butts smoldering in an ashtray, Big Jim scoffed.
A vein was pulsing in his temple, and his heart was beating too hard. He knew he'd eaten too fast, again, but he just couldn't help it. When he was hungry, he gobbled until whatever was in front of him was gone. It was his nature.
Anyone could have put it out. You could have put it out. Point is, I know who voted for me last time, and I know who didn't. Those who didn't get no cotton-pickin' candy.
Fern asked Big Jim what he, Fern, was supposed to do with the pumps.
Just make sure they're in the fire barn. Then come on over to the middle school. We'll be in the gym.
Fern said Roger Killian wanted to say something. Big Jim rolled his eyes but waited. Roger wanted to know which of his boys was going on the cops. Big Jim sighed, scrabbled through the litter of papers on his desk, and found the one with the list of new officers on it. Most were high schoolers, and all were male. The youngest, Mickey Wardlaw, was only 15, but he was a bruiser, right tackle on the football team until he'd been kicked off for drinking.
Ricky and Randall.
Roger protested that them was his oldest, and the only ones who could be reliably counted on for chorin. Who, he asked, was going to help out with them chickens?
Big Jim closed his eyes and prayed to God for strength.
16. Sammy was very aware of the low rolling pain in her stomach, like menstrual cramps, and much sharper twinges coming from lower down. They would have been hard to miss because another one came with each step. Nevertheless, she kept plodding along 119 toward the Motton Road. She would keep on no matter how much it hurt. She had a destination in mind, and it wasn't her trailer either. What she wanted wasn't in the trailer, but she knew where it could be found. She'd walk to it, even if it took her all night. If the pain got really bad, she had 5 Percocet tablets in her jeans pocket, and she could chew them up. They work faster when you chewed them. Phil had told her that.
Do her. We'd come back and really fuck you up. Do that, bitch. You better learn to keep your mouth for when you're on your knees. Do her. Do that, bitch. No one would believe you anyway.
But the Reverend Libby had. And look what happened to her. Dislocated shoulder, dead dog.
Do that, bitch.
Sammy thought she would hear that pig's squealing, excited voice in her head until she died. So she walked. Overhead, the first pink stars glimmered, sparks seen through a dirty pane of glass. Headlights appeared, making her shadow jump long on the road ahead. A clattery old farm truck pulled up and stopped.
Here. Climb in, the man behind the wheel said.
Only it came out, Hey, Year Lyman, because it was Alden Dinsmore, father of the late Rory, and Alden was drunk. Nevertheless, Sammy climbed in, moving with an invalid's care. Alden didn't appear to notice. There was a 16-ounce can of Bud between his legs and a half-empty case beside him. Empties rolled and rattled around Sammy's feet.
"Where are you going?" Alden asked. "Pouring bossum?"
He laughed, to show that, drunk or not, he could make a joke.
"Only out Motton Road, sir. Are you going that way?"
"Any way you want," Alden said. "I'm just driving. Driving and thinking about my boy. He died on Saturday."
"I'm real sorry for your loss."
He nodded and drank.
"My dad died last winter, you know it? Gassed himself to death, poor old fella. Emphysema. Spent the last year of his life on oxygen. Rory used to change his tanks. He loved that old bastard."
"I'm sorry."
She'd already said that, but what else was there to say? A tear crept down his cheek.
"I'll go any way you want, Missy Lou. Gonna keep driving until the beer's gone. You want beer?"
"Yes, please."
The beer was warm, but she drank greedily. She was very thirsty. She fished one of the perks out of her pocket and swallowed it with another long gulp. She felt the buzz hit her in the head. It was fine. She fished out another perk and offered it to Alden.
"Want one of these? They make you feel better."
He took it and swallowed it with beer, not bothering to ask what it was. Here was the Motton Road. He saw the intersection late and swung wide, knocking the Crumley's mailbox flat. Sammy didn't mind.
"Grab another, Missy Lou."
"Thank you, sir."
She took another beer and popped the top.
"Wom see my boy?"
In the glow of the dashboard lights, Alden's eyes looked yellow and wet. They were the eyes of a dog who'd stepped in a hole and went leg broke.
"Wom see my boy Rory?"
"Yes, sir," Sammy said. "I sure do. I was there, you know."
"Everybody was. I rented my feel. Probably helped to kill him. Didn't know. We never know, do we?"
"No," Sammy said.
Alden dug into the bib pocket of his overalls and pulled out a battered wallet. He took both hands off the wheel to pull it open, squinting and flipping through the little celluloid pockets.
"My boys gave me this warrant," he said. "Rory and Ori. Ori's still alive."
"That's a nice wallet," Sammy said,
leaning across to take hold of the steering wheel. She had done the same for Phil when they were living together, many times. Mr. Dinsmore's truck went from side to side in slow and somehow solemn arcs, barely missing another mailbox. But that was all right. The poor old guy was only doing 20, and Motton Road was deserted. On the radio, WCIK was playing low. "Sweet Hope of Heaven" by the Blind Boys of Alabama. Alden thrust the wallet at her.
"There he is. There's my boy. With his grandpa."
"Will you drive while I look?" Sammy asked.
"Sure."
Alden took the wheel back. The truck began to move a little faster and a little straighter, although it was more or less straddling the white line. The photograph was a faded color shot of a young boy and an old man with their arms around each other. The old man was wearing a Red Sox cap and an oxygen mask. The boy had a big grin on his face.
"He's a beautiful boy, sir," Sammy said.
"Yeah, beautiful boy. Beautiful smart boy."
Alden let out a tearless bray of pain. He sounded like a donkey. Spittle flew from his lips. The truck plunged, then came right again.
"I have a beautiful boy, too," Sammy said.
She began to cry. Once, she remembered, she had taken pleasure in torturing brats. Now she knew how it felt to be in the microwave herself, burning in the microwave.
"I'm going to kiss him when I see him. Kiss him once more."
"You kiss him," Alden said.
"I will."
"You kiss him and hug him and hold him."
"I will, sir,"
I'd kiss my boy if I could. I'd kiss his cold, cold cheek.
I know you would, sir.
But we buried him this morning right on the place.
I'm so sorry for your loss.
Have another beer.
Thank you.
She had another beer. She was getting drunk. It was lovely to be drunk. In this fashion, they progressed, as the pink stars grew brighter overhead, flickering but not falling. No meteor showers tonight. They passed Sammy's trailer, where she'd never go again, without slowing.
17. It was about 7:45 when Rose Twitchell knocked on the glass panel of the Democrats' door. Julia, Pete, and Tony were standing at a long table, creating copies of the newspaper's latest 4-page broadside. Pete and Tony put them together. Julia stapled them and added them to the pile. When she saw Rose, Julia waved her in energetically. Rose opened the door, then staggered a little.
"Geez, it's hot in here."
"Turned off the AC to save juice," Pete Freeman said, "and the copier gets hot when it's overused, which it has been tonight." But he looked proud. Rose thought they all looked proud.
"Thought you'd be overwhelmed at the restaurant," Tony said.
"Just the opposite. Could have shot deer in there tonight. I think a lot of people don't want to face me because my cook's been arrested for murder. And I think a lot of people don't want to face each other because of what happened at Food City this morning."
"Come on over here and grab a copy of the paper," Julia said. "You're a cover girl, Rose."
At the top, in red, were the words "Free, Dome Crisis Edition, Free." And below that, in 16-point type Julia had never used until the last two editions of the Democrat, "Riot and Murders as Crisis Deepens." The picture was of Rose herself. She was in profile. The bullhorn was to her lips. An errant lock of hair lay on her forehead, and she looked extraordinarily beautiful. In the background was the pasta and juices aisle, with several bottles of what looked like spaghetti sauce smashed on the floor. The caption read, "Quiet Riot. Rose Twitchell, owner and proprietor of Sweetbriar Rose, quells food riot with the help of Dale Barbara, who has been arrested for murder. See story below in editorial, page 4.
"Holy God," Rose said. "Well, at least you got my good side, if I can be said to have one."
"Rose," Tony Gay said solemnly, "you look like Michelle Pfeiffer." Rose snorted and flipped him the bird. She was already turning to the editorial. "Panic Now, Shame Later," by Julia Shumway. Not everybody in Chester's Mill knows Dale Barbara. He is a relative newcomer to our town, but most people have eaten his cooking in Sweetbriar Rose. Those who do know him would have said before today that he was a real addition to the community, taking his turn at umpiring softball games in July and August, helping out with the middle school book drive in September, and picking up trash on Common Cleanup Day just 2 weeks ago. Then today, Barbie, as he is known by those who do know him, was arrested for 4 shocking murders, murders of people who are well-known and well-loved in this town, people who, unlike Dale Barbara, have lived here most or all of their lives. Under ordinary circumstances, Barbie would have been taken to the Castle County Jail, offered his one phone call, and provided with a lawyer if he couldn't afford one. He would have been charged, and the evidence gathering, by experts who know what they are doing, would have begun. None of that has happened, and we all know why. Because of the dome that has now sealed our town off from the rest of the world. But have due process and common sense also been sealed off? No matter how shocking the crime, unproved accusations are not enough to excuse the way Dale Barbara has been treated, or to explain the new police chief's refusal to answer questions, or allow this correspondent to verify that Dale Barbara is still alive, although the father of Dorothy Sanders, First Selectman Andrew Sanders, was allowed to not only visit this uncharged prisoner, but to vilify him.
"Phew," Rose said, looking up. "You're really going to print this?"
Julia gestured to the stacked copies.
"It's already printed. Why? Do you object?"
"No, but..."
Rose was rapidly scanning the rest of the editorial, which was very long, and increasingly pro-Barbie. It ended with an appeal for anyone with information about the crimes to come forward, and the suggestion that when the crisis ended, as it surely would, the behavior of the residents regarding these murders would be closely scrutinized not just in Maine or the United States, but all over the world.
Aren't you afraid you'll get in trouble?
Freedom of the press, Rose, Pete said, sounding remarkably unsure himself.
It's what Horace Greeley would have done, Julia said firmly, and at the sound of his name, her corgi, who had been asleep on his dog bed in the corner, looked up.
He saw Rose and came over for a pat or two, which Rose was happy to provide.
Do you have more than what's in here? Rose asked, tapping the editorial.
A little, Julia said. I'm holding it back, hoping for more.
Barbie could never have done a thing like this, but I'm afraid for him just the same.
One of the cell phones scattered on the desk rang. Tony snared it. Democrat, gay. He listened, then held out the phone to Julia. Colonel Cox, for you. He doesn't sound like a happy camper. Cox. Julia had forgotten all about him. She took the telephone.
Ms. Shumway, I need to talk to Barbie and find out what sort of progress he's making in taking administrative control there.
I don't think that will be happening anytime soon, Julia said. He's in jail.
Jail? Charged with what?
Murder, 4 counts to be exact.
You're joking.
Do I sound like I'm joking, Colonel?
There was a moment of silence. She could hear many voices in the background. When Cox spoke again, his voice was low.
Explain this.
No, Colonel Cox, I think not. I've been writing about it for the last 2 hours, and as my mother used to say when I was a little girl, I don't chew my cabbage twice. Are you still in Maine?
Castle Rock. Our forward base is here.
Then I suggest that you meet me where we met before. Motton Road. I can't give you a copy of tomorrow's Democrat, even though it's free, but I can hold it up to the dome and you can read it for yourself.
Email it to me.
I won't. I think email is antithetical to the newspaper business. I'm very old-fashioned that way.
You're an irritating piece of work, dear lady.
I may be irritating, but I'm not your dear lady.
Tell me this, is it a frame job, something to do with Sanders and Rennie?
Colonel, in your experience, does a bear defecate in the woods?
Silence.
Then he said, I'll meet you in an hour.
I'll be bringing company, Barbie's employer. I think you'll be interested in what she has to say.
Fine.
Julia hung up the phone.
Want to take a little ride with me out to the dome, Rose? If it'll help Barbie, sure.
We can hope, but I'm kind of thinking we're on our own here. Julia shifted her attention to Pete and Tony.
Will you two finish stapling those? Stack them by the door and lock up when you leave. Get a good night's sleep, because tomorrow we all get to be newsboys. This paper's getting the old school treatment. Every house in town. The close-in farms and Eastchester, of course. Lots of new people out there, theoretically less susceptible to the Big Jim mystique.
Pete raised his eyebrows.
Our Mr. Rennie's the home team, Julia said. He's going to climb onto the stump at the emergency town meeting Thursday night and try to wind this town up like a pocket watch. The visitors get first ups, though.
She pointed at the newspapers.
Those are our first ups. If enough people read that, he'll have some tough questions to answer before he gets to speechifying. Maybe we can disrupt his rhythm a little.
Maybe a lot, if we find out who did the rock throwing at Food City, Pete said. And you know what? I think we will. I think this whole thing was put together on the fly. There's got to be loose ends.
I just hope Barbie's still alive when we start pulling them, Julia said. She looked at her watch. Come on, Rosie. Let's take a ride. You want to come, Horace?
Horace did.
18.
You can let me off here, sir, Sammy said.
It was a pleasant ranch style in Eastchester. Although the house was dark, the lawn was lit, because they were now close to the dome where bright lights had been set up at the Chester's Mill Harlow town line.
Want another beer for the road, Miss Illou?
No, sir, this is the end of the road for me.
Although it wasn't. She still had to go back to town. In the yellow glow cast by the dome light, Alden Dinsmore looked 85 instead of 45. She had never seen such a sad face. Except maybe for her own, in the mirror of her hospital room before she set out on this journey. She leaned over and kissed his cheek. The stubble there prickled her lips. He put his hand to the spot and actually smiled a little.
You ought to go home now, sir. You've got a wife to think about and another boy to take care of.
I suppose you're right.
I am right.
You'll be okay?
Yes, sir.
She got out, then turned back to him.
Will you?
I'll try, he said.
Sammy slammed the door and stood at the end of the driveway watching him turn around. He went into the ditch, but it was dry, and he got out all right. He headed back toward 119, weaving at first. Then the taillight settled into a more or less straight line. He was in the middle of the road again, fucking the white line, Phil would have said. But she thought that would be okay. It was going on 8:30 now, full dark. And she didn't think he'd meet anyone. When his taillights winked out of sight, she walked up to the dark ranch house. It wasn't much compared to some of the fine old homes on Town Common Hill, but nicer than anything she'd ever had. It was nice inside, too. She had been here once with Phil, back in the days when he did nothing but sell a little weed and cook a little glass out back of the trailer for his own use. Back before he started getting his strange ideas about Jesus, and going to that crappy church, where they believed everybody was going to hell but them. Religion was where Phil's trouble had started. It had led him to Coggins, and Coggins, or someone else, had turned him into the chef. The people who had lived here weren't tweakers. Tweakers wouldn't be able to keep a house like this for long. They'd freebase the mortgage. But Jack and Myra Evans had enjoyed a little wacky tobacco from time to time, and Phil Bushy had been happy to supply it. They were nice people, and Phil had treated them nice. Back in those days, he'd still been capable of treating people nice. Myra gave them iced coffee. Sammy had been 7 or so months gone, with little Walter then, showing plenty, and Myra had asked her if she wanted a boy or a girl, not looking down her nose a bit. Jack had taken Phil into his little office den to pay him, and Phil had called to her. Hey, honey, you should get a load of this. It all seemed so long ago. She tried the front door. It was locked. She picked up one of the decorative stones that bordered Myra's flower bed and stood in front of the picture window, hefting it in her hand. After some thought, she went around back instead of throwing it. Climbing through a window would be difficult in her current condition, and even if she was able and careful, she might cut herself badly enough to interfere with the rest of her plans for the evening. Also, it was a nice house. She didn't want to vandalize it if she didn't have to. And she didn't. Jack's body had been taken away. The town was still functioning well enough for that. But no one had thought to lock the back door. Sammy walked right in. There was no generator, and it was darker than a raccoon's asshole. But there was a box of wooden matches on the kitchen stove. And the first one she lit showed her a flashlight on the kitchen table. It worked just fine. The beam illuminated what looked like a blood stain on the floor. She switched it away from that in a hurry and started for Jack Evans' office den. It was right off the living room, a cubby so small that there was really room for no more than a desk and a glass-fronted cabinet. She ran the beam of the flashlight across the desk, then raised it so that it reflected in the glassy eyes of Jack's most treasured trophy, the head of a moose he'd shot up in TR-90 3 years before. The moose head was what Phil had called her in to see.
I got the last ticket in the lottery that year, Jack had told them, and bagged him with that.
He pointed at the rifle in the cabinet. It was a fearsome-looking thing with a scope. Myra had come into the doorway, the ice rattling in her own glass of iced coffee, looking cool and pretty and amused. The kind of woman, Sammy knew, she herself would never be.
It cost far too much, but I let him have it after he promised he'd take me to Bermuda for a week next December.
Bermuda, Sammy said now, looking at the moose head. But she never got to go. That's too sad.
Phil, putting the envelope with the cash in it into his back pocket, had said,
Awesome rifle, but not exactly the thing for home protection.
I've got that covered, too, Jack had replied. And although he hadn't shown Phil just how he had it covered, he'd patted the top of his desk meaningfully. Got a couple of damn good handguns. Phil had nodded back just as meaningfully. Sammy and Myra had exchanged a boys-will-be-boys look of perfect harmony. She still remembered how good that look had made her feel, how included. And she supposed that was part of the reason she had come here instead of trying someplace else, someplace closer to town. She paused to chew down another Percocet, then started opening the desk drawers. They were unlocked, and so was the wooden box in the third one she tried. Inside was the late Jack Evans' extra gun, a .45 Springfield XD automatic pistol. She took it, and after a little fumbling, ejected the magazine. It was full, and there was a spare clip in the drawer. She took that one, too. Then she went back to the kitchen to find a bag to carry it in, and keys, of course, to whatever might be parked in the late Jack and Myra's garage. She had no intention of walking back to town. 19. Julia and Rose were discussing what the future might hold for their town when their present nearly ended. Would have ended, if they had met the old farm truck on Estee Bend, about a mile and a half from their destination. But Julia got through the curve in time to see that the truck was in her lane and coming at her head-on. She swung the wheel of her Prius hard left without thinking, getting into the other lane, and the two vehicles missed each other by inches. Horace, who'd been sitting on the back seat, wearing his usual expression of, "Oh boy, going for a ride," delight, tumbled to the floor with a surprised yip. It was the only sound. Neither woman screamed or even cried out. It was too quick for that. Death or serious injury passed them by in an instant and was gone. Julia swung back into her own lane, then pulled onto the soft shoulder and put her Prius in park. She looked at Rose. Rose looked back, all big eyes and open mouth. In back, Horace jumped onto the seat again and gave a single bark, as if to ask what the delay was. At the sound, both women laughed, and Rose began patting her chest above the substantial shelf of her bosom. "My heart, my heart," she said. "Yeah," Julia said. "Mine, too. Did you see how close that was?" Rose laughed again shakily. "You kidding, hun? If I'd had my arm cocked out the window, that son of a bitch would have amputated my elbow." Julia shook her head. "Drunk, probably." "Drunk, assuredly," Rose said, and snorted. "Are you okay to go on?" "Are you?" Rose asked. "Yes," Julia said. "How about you, Horace?" Horace barked that he had been born ready. "A near miss rubs the bad luck off," Rose said. "That's what Granddad Twitchell used to claim." "I hope he was right," Julia said, and got rolling again. She watched closely for oncoming headlights, but the next glow they saw was from the spots set up at the Harlow edge of the dome. They didn't see Sammy Bushy. Sammy saw them. She was standing in front of the Evans garage with the key to the Evans Malibu in her hand. When they had gone by, she raised the garage door. She had to do it by hand, and it hurt considerably, and got behind the wheel. 20. There was an alley between Burpee's department store and the Mill Gas and Grocery, connecting Main Street and West Street. It was used mostly by delivery trucks. At 9:15 that night, Junior Rennie and Carter Thibodeau walked up this alley in almost perfect darkness. Carter was carrying a 5-gallon can, red with a yellow diagonal stripe on the side in one hand. "Gasoline," read the word on the stripe. In the other hand, he held a battery-powered bullhorn. This had been white, but Carter had wrapped the horn in black masking tape so it wouldn't stand out if anyone looked their way before they could fade back down the alley. Junior was wearing a backpack. His head no longer ached and his limp had all but disappeared. He was confident that his body was finally beating whatever had fucked it up. Possibly a lingering virus of some kind. You could pick up every kind of shit at college, and getting the boot for beating up that kid had probably been a blessing in disguise. At the head of the alley, they had a clear view of the Democrat. Light spilled out onto the empty sidewalk, and they could see Freeman and Gay moving around inside, carrying stacks of paper to the door, and then setting them down. The old wooden structure housing the newspaper and Julia's living quarters stood between Sanders' hometown drug and the bookstore, but was separated from both by a paved walkway on the bookstore side, and an alley like the one in which he and Carter were currently lurking on the drugstore side. It was a windless night, and he thought that if his father mobilized the troops quickly enough, there would be no collateral damage. Not that he cared. If the entire east side of Main Street burned, that would be fine with Junior. Just more trouble for Dale Barbara.
He could still feel those cool, assessing eyes on him. It wasn't right to be looked at that way, especially when the man doing the looking was behind bars. Fucking Barbie. I should have shot him, Junior muttered.
What? Carter asked.
Nothing.
He wiped his forehead.
Hot.
Yeah. Frankie says that this keeps on, we're all apt to end up stewed like prunes.
When are we supposed to do this? Junior shrugged sullenly. His father had told him, but he couldn't exactly remember. 10 o'clock, maybe? But what did it matter? Let those two over there burn. And if the newspaper bitch was upstairs, perhaps relaxing with her favorite dildo after a hard day, let her burn, too. More trouble for Barbie.
Let's do it now, he said.
You sure, bro?
You see anyone on the street?
Carter looked. Main Street was deserted and mostly dark. The Jennies behind the newspaper office and the drugstore were the only ones he could hear. He shrugged.
All right. Why not?
Junior undid the pack's buckles and flipped back the flap. On top were two pair of light gloves. He gave one pair to Carter and put on the other. Beneath was a bundle wrapped in a bath towel. He opened it and set 4 empty wine bottles on the patched asphalt. At the very bottom of the pack was a tin funnel. Junior put it in one of the wine bottles and reached for the gasoline.
Better let me, bro, Carter said. Your hands are shaking.
Junior looked at them with surprise. He didn't feel shaky, but yes, they were trembling.
I'm not afraid, if that's what you're thinking.
Never said you were. It ain't a head problem. Anybody can see that. You need to go to Everett because you got something wrong with you, and he's the closest thing we got to a doctor right now.
I feel fine.
Shut up before someone hears you. Do the fucking towel while I do this. Junior took his gun from his holster and shot Carter in the eye. His head exploded, blood and brains everywhere. Then Junior stood over him, shooting him again and again and again.
Junes.
Junior shook his head to clear away this vision. So vivid it was hallucinatory. And realized his hand was actually gripping the butt of his pistol. Maybe that virus wasn't quite out of his system yet. And maybe it wasn't a virus after all.
What, then? What?
The fragrant odor of gas smacked his nostrils hard enough to make his eyes burn. Carter had begun filling the first bottle. Glug, glug, glug went the gas can. Junior unzipped the side pocket of the backpack and brought out a pair of his mother's sewing scissors. He used them to cut 4 strips from the towel. He stuffed one into the first bottle, then pulled it out and stuck the other end inside, letting a length of gasoline-soaked terry cloth hang. He repeated the process with the others. His hands weren't shaking too badly for that. 21. Barbie's Colonel Cox had changed from the last time Julia had seen him. He had a good shave for going on 9:30, and his hair was combed, but his khakis had lost their neat press, and tonight his poplin jacket seemed to be bagging on him as if he'd lost weight. He was standing in front of a few smudges of spray paint left over from the unsuccessful acid experiment, and he was frowning at the bracket shape, like he thought he could walk through it if he only concentrated hard enough. Close your eyes and click your heels 3 times, Julia thought, because there's no place like Dome. She introduced Rose to Cox and Cox to Rose. During their brief getting-to-know-you exchange, Julia looked around, not liking what she saw. The lights were still in place, shining at the sky as if signaling a glitzy Hollywood premiere, and there was a purring generator to run them. But the trucks were gone. And so was the big green HQ tent that had been erected 40 or 50 yards down the road. A patch of flattened grass marked the place where it had been. There were 2 soldiers with Cox, but they had the not-ready-for-primetime look she associated with aides or attachés. The sentries probably weren't gone, but they had been moved back, establishing a perimeter beyond hailing distance of any poor slobs who might wander up on the mill side to ask what was going on. Ask now, plead later, Julia thought. Fill me in, Miss Shumway,
Cox said. First, answer a question.
He rolled his eyes. She thought she would have slapped him for that if she'd been able to get at him. Her nerves were still jangled from the near miss on the ride out here. But he told her to ask away.
Have we been abandoned?
Absolutely not,
he replied promptly, but didn't quite meet her eye. She thought that was a worse sign than the queerly empty look she now saw on his side of the dome, as if there had been a circus, but it had moved on. Read this, she said, and plastered the front page of tomorrow's paper against the dome's unseen surface, like a woman mounting a sale notice in a department store window. There was a faint, fugitive thrum in her fingers, like the kind of static shock you could get from touching metal on a cold winter morning when the air was dry. After that, nothing. He read the entire paper, telling her when to turn the pages. It took him 10 minutes. When he finished, she said, "As you probably noticed, ad space is way down, but I flatter myself the quality of the writing has gone up. Fuckery seems to bring out the best in me."
"Miss Shumway."
"Oh, why not call me Julia? We're practically old pals."
"Fine. You're Julia and I'm J.C.
I'll try not to confuse you with the one who walked on water."
He believed this fellow Rennie's setting himself up as a dictator, a kind of Down East Manuel Noriega.
"It's the progression to Pol Pot I'm worried about."
"Do you think that's possible?"
2 days ago, I would have laughed at the idea. He's a used car salesman when he isn't running selectmen's meetings. But 2 days ago, we hadn't had a food riot. Nor did we know about these murders. "Not Barbie," Rose said, shaking her head with stubborn weariness. "Never."
Cox took no notice of this, not because he was ignoring Rose, Julia felt, but because he thought the idea was too ridiculous to warrant any attention. It warmed her toward him, at least a little. "Do you think Rennie committed the murders, Julia?"
"I've been thinking about that. Everything he's done since the dome appeared, from shutting down alcohol sales to appointing a complete dope as police chief, has been political, aimed at increasing his own clout."
"Are you saying murder isn't in his repertoire?"
"Not necessarily. When his wife passed, there were rumors that he might have helped her along. I don't say they were true, but for rumors like that to start in the first place says something about how people see the man in question."
Cox grunted agreement.
"But for the life of me, I can't see how murdering and sexually abusing 2 teenage girls could be political." "Bobby would never," Rose said again. "The same with Coggins, although that ministry of his, especially the radio station part, is suspiciously well endowed. Brenda Perkins, now, that could have been political." "And you can't send in the Marines to stop him, can you?" Rose asked. "All you guys can do is watch, like kids looking into an aquarium where the biggest fish takes all the food, then starts eating the little ones."
"I can kill the cellular service," Cox mused. "Also internet. I can do that much."
"The police have walkie-talkies," Julia said. "He'll switch to those. And at the meeting on Thursday night, when people complain about losing their links to the outside world, he'll blame you."
"We were planning a press conference on Friday. I could pull the plug on that."
Julia grew cold at the thought. "Don't you dare. Then he wouldn't have to explain himself to the outside world. Plus," Rose said, "if you kill the phones and the internet, no one can tell you or anyone else what he's doing." Cox stood quiet for a moment, looking at the ground. Then he raised his head.
"What about this hypothetical generator that's maintaining the dome? Any luck?"
Julia wasn't sure she wanted to tell Cox that they had put a middle school kid in charge of hunting for it. As it turned out, she didn't have to, because that was when the town fire whistle went off. 22. Pete Freeman dropped the last stack of papers by the door, then he straightened up, put his hands in the small of his back, and stretched his spine. Tony Gay heard the crackle all the way across the room.
"That sounds like it hurt."
"Nope, feels good."
"My wife will be in the sack by now," Tony said, "and I've got a bottle rat-holed in my garage. Want to come by for a nip on your way home?"
"No, I think I'll just..." Pete began. And that was when the first bottle crashed through the window. He saw the flaming wick from the corner of his eye and took a step backward. Only one, but it saved him from being seriously burned, perhaps even cooked alive. The window and the bottle both shattered,
The gasoline ignited and flared in a bright manta shape. Pete simultaneously ducked and pivoted from the hips. The fire manta flew past him, igniting one sleeve of his shirt before landing on the carpet in front of Julia's desk.
"What the fuck?"
Tony began, and then another bottle came arcing through the hole. This one smashed on top of Julia's desk and rolled across it, spreading fire among the papers littered there and dripping more fire down the front. The smell of burning gas was hot and rich. Pete ran for the water cooler in the corner, beating the sleeve of his shirt against his side. He lifted the water bottle awkwardly against his middle, then held his flaming shirt. The arm beneath now felt as if it were developing a bad sunburn. Under the bottle's spouting mouth. Another Molotov cocktail flew out of the night. It fell short, shattering on the sidewalk and lighting a small bonfire on the concrete. Tendrils of flaming gasoline ran into the gutter and went out.
"Dump the water on the carpet!" Tony shouted. "Dump it before the whole place catches fire!"
Pete only looked at him, dazed and panting. The water in the cooler bottle continued to gush onto a part of the carpet that did not, unfortunately, need wetting. Although his sports reporting was always going to be strictly junior varsity, Tony Gay had been a three-letter man in high school. 10 years later, his reflexes were still mostly intact. He snatched the spouting cooler bottle from Pete and held it first over the top of Julia's desk, and then over the carpet blaze. The fire was already spreading, but maybe, if he was quick, and if there was another bottle or two in the hallway leading to the supply closet.
"More!"
he shouted at Pete, who was gaping at the smoking remains of his shirt sleeve.
"Back hall!"
For a moment, Pete didn't seem to understand. Then he got it and booked for the hall. Tony stepped around Julia's desk, letting the last pint or two of water fall in the flames, trying to get a foothold there. Then the final Molotov cocktail came flying out of the dark, and that was the one that really did the damage. It made a direct hit on the stacks of newspapers the men had placed near the front door. Burning gasoline ran beneath the baseboard at the front of the office and leaped up. Seen through the flames, Main Street was a wavering mirage. On the far side of the mirage across the street, Tony could see two dim figures. The rising heat made them look like they were dancing.
"Free Dale Barbara, or this is just the beginning," an amplified voice bellowed. "There are plenty of us, and we'll firebomb the whole damn town. Free Dale Barbara, or pay the price."
Tony looked down and saw a hot creek of fire run between his feet. He had no more water with which to put it out. Soon it would finish eating through the carpet and taste the old dry wood beneath. Meanwhile, the whole front of the office was now involved. Tony dropped the empty cooler bottle and stepped back. The heat was already intense. He could feel it stretching his skin. If not for the goddamn newspapers, I might have... But it was too late for might haves. He turned and saw Pete standing in the doorway from the back hall with another bottle of Poland Spring in his arms. Most of his charred shirt sleeve had dropped away. The skin beneath was bright red.
"Too late!" Tony shouted.
He gave Julia's desk, which was now a pillar of fire shooting all the way to the ceiling, a wide berth, raising one arm to shield his face from the heat.
"Too late! Out the back!"
Pete Freeman needed no further urging. He heaved the bottle at the growing fire and ran.
23.
Carrie Carver rarely had anything to do with Mill Gas and Grocery. Although the little convenience store had made her and her husband a pretty good living over the years, she saw herself as above all that. But when Johnny suggested they might go down in the van and take the remaining canned goods up to the house for safekeeping, was the delicate way he put it, she had agreed at once. And although she was ordinarily not much of a worker, watching Judge Judy was more her speed, she had volunteered to help. She hadn't been at Food City, but when she had gone down later to inspect the damage with her friend Leah Anderson, the shattered windows and the blood still on the pavement had frightened her badly. Those things had frightened her for the future. Johnny lugged out the cartons of soups, stews, beans, and sauces. Carrie stowed them in the bed of their Dodge Ram. They were about halfway through the job when fire bloomed downstreet. They both heard the amplified voice. Carrie thought she saw two or three figures running down the alley beside Burpee's, but wasn't sure. Later on, she would be sure, and would up the number of shadowy figures to at least four. Probably five.
What does it mean? She asked. Honey, what does it mean?
That the goddamn murdering bastard isn't on his own, Johnny said. It means he's got a gang.
Carrie's hand was on his arm, and now she dug in with her nails. Johnny freed his arm and ran for the police station, yelling fire at the top of his lungs. Instead of following, Carrie Carver continued loading the truck. She was more frightened of the future than ever.
24.
In addition to Roger Killian and the Bowie brothers, there were 10 new officers from what was now the Chester's Mill hometown security force sitting on the bleachers of the middle school gymnasium. And Big Jim had only gotten started on his speech about what a responsibility they had when the fire whistle went off. The boy's early, he thought. I can't trust him to save my soul. Never could. But now he's that much worse.
Well, boys, he said, directing his attention particularly to young Mickey Wardlaw. God, what a bruiser. I had a lot more to say, but it seems we've got ourselves a little more excitement. Fern Bowie, do you happen to know if we have any Indian pumps in the FD barn?
Fern said he'd had a peek into the fire barn earlier that evening just to see what sort of equipment there might be, and there were almost a dozen Indian pumps, all full of water too, which was convenient. Big Jim, thinking that sarcasm should be reserved for those bright enough to understand what it was, said it was the good Lord looking out for them. He also said that if it was more than a false alarm, he would take charge with Stuart Bowie as his second in command. There, you nosy Parker witch, he thought, as the new officers, looking bright-eyed and eager, rose from the bleachers. Let's see how you like getting in my business now.
25. Where you going? Carter asked. He had driven his car with the lights off down to where West Street teed into Route 117. The building that stood here was a Texaco station that had closed up in 2007. It was close to town but offered good cover, which made it convenient. Back the way they had come, the fire whistle was honking 6 licks to a dozen, and the first light of the fire, more pink than orange, was rising in the sky.
Huh?
Junior was looking at the strengthening glow. It made him feel horny. It made him wish he still had a girlfriend.
I asked you where you're going. Your dad set the alibi up.
I left Unit 2 behind the post office, Junior said,
taking his eyes reluctantly away from the fire.
Me and Freddie Denton's together, and he'll say we were together. All night, I can cut across from here. Might go back by West Street. Get a look at how it's catching on.
He uttered a high-pitched giggle, almost a girl's giggle, that caused Carter to look at him strangely.
Don't look too long. Arsonists are always getting caught by going back to look at their fires. I saw that in America's Most Wanted.
Nobody's wearing the golden sombrero for this motherfucker except Barbie, Junior said. What about you? Where are you going?
Home. Ma'll say I was there all night. I'll get her to change the bandage on my shoulder. Fucking dog bite. Hurts like a bastard. Take some aspirin. And come on down, help fight the fire.
They've got heavier dope than aspirin at the health center and the hospital. Also the drugstore. We ought to look into that shit.
No doubt, Carter said.
Or, do you tweak? I think I can get some of that.
Meth? Never mess with it. But I wouldn't mind some oxy.
Oxy! Junior exclaimed.
Why had he never thought of that? It would probably fix his headaches a lot better than Zomig or Imitrex.
Yeah, bro. You talk about it.
He raised his fist. Carter bumped it. But he had no intention of getting high with Junior. Junior was weird now.
Better get going, Jones.
I'm taillights.
Junior opened the door and walked away, still limping a little. Carter was surprised at how relieved he was when Junior was gone.
26. Barbie woke to the sound of the fire whistle and saw Melvin Searles standing outside his cell. The boy's fly was unzipped, and he was holding his considerable cock in his hand. When he saw he had Barbie's attention, he began to piss. His goal was clearly to reach the bunk. He couldn't quite make it and settled for a splattery letter S on the concrete instead. "Go on, Bobby, drink up," he said. "You gotta be thirsty. It's a little salty, but what the fuck?"
"What's burning?"
"As if you didn't know," Mel said, smiling. He was still pale. He must have lost a fair amount of blood, but the bandage around his head was crisp and unstained.
"Pretend I don't."
"Your pals burned down the newspaper," Mel said, and now his smile showed his teeth. Barbie realized the kid was furious. Frightened, too. "Trying to scare us into letting you out. But we don't scare."
"Why would I burn down the newspaper? Why not the town hall? And who are these pals of mine supposed to be?"
Mel was tucking his cock back into his pants.
"You won't be thirsty tomorrow, Barbie. Don't worry about that. We've got a whole bucket of water with your name on it and a sponge to go with it."
Barbie was silent. "You seen that waterboarding shit in Iraq?" Mel nodded as if he knew Barbie had.
"Now you'll get to experience it firsthand."
He pointed a finger through the bars. "We're gonna find out who your confederates are, fuckwad. And we're gonna find out what you did to lock this town up in the first place. That waterboarding shit? Nobody stands up to that."
He started away, then turned back. "Not fresh water either. Salt, first thing. You think about it."
Mel left, clumping up the basement hallway with his bandage head lowered. Barbie sat on the bunk, looked at the drying snake of Mel's urine on the floor, and listened to the fire whistle. He thought of the girl in the pick-em-up, the blondie who almost gave him a ride and then changed her mind. He closed his eyes.
Ashes. 1. Rusty was standing in the turnaround in front of the hospital, watching the flames rise from somewhere on Main Street, when the cell phone clipped to his belt played its little song. Twitch and Gina were with him, Gina holding Twitch's arm as if for protection. Ginny Tomlinson and Harriet Bigelow were both sleeping in the staff lounge. The old fellow who had volunteered, Thurston Marshall, was making medication rounds. He had turned out to be surprisingly good. The lights and the equipment were back on, and, for the time being, things were on an even keel. Until the fire whistle went off, Rusty had actually dared to feel good. He saw Linda on the screen and said, "Hun, everything okay?"
"Here, yes, kids are asleep."
"Do you know what's bur—"
"The newspaper office. Be quiet and listen, because I'm turning my phone off in about a minute and a half, so nobody can call me in to help fight the fire. Jackie's here. She'll watch the kids. You need to meet me at the funeral home. Stacy Morgan will be there, too. She came by earlier. She's with us."
The name, while familiar, did not immediately call up a face in Rusty's mind. And what resonated was, "She's with us." There really were starting to be sides. Starting to be with us and with them.
"Lynn, meet me there 10 minutes. It's safe as long as they're fighting the fire because the Bowie brothers are on the crew. Stacy says so."
"How did they get a crew together so far?"
"I don't know and don't care. Can you come?"
"Yes."
"Good. Don't use the parking lot on the side. Go around back to the smaller one."
Then the voice was gone.
"What's on fire?" Gina asked. "Do you know?"
"No," Rusty said. "Because nobody called."
He looked at them both, and hard. Gina didn't follow, but Twitch did.
"Nobody at all." "I just took off, probably on a call, but you don't know where. I didn't say, right?"
Gina still looked puzzled, but nodded. Because now these people were her people. She did not question the fact. Why would she? She was only 17. Us and them, Rusty thought. Bad medicine, usually. Especially for 17-year-olds.
"Probably on a call," she said. "We don't know where."
"Nope," Twitch agreed. "You grasshopper, we lowly ants."
"Don't make a big deal of it, either of you," Rusty said.
But it was a big deal. He knew that already. It was trouble.
Gina wasn't the only kid in the picture. He and Linda had a pair, now fast asleep, and with no knowledge that Mom and Dad might be sailing into a storm much too big for their little boat. And still, I'll be back, Rusty said, and hoped that wasn't just wishful thinking. 2. Sammy Bushy drove the Evans' Malibu down Catherine Russell Drive not long after Rusty headed for the Bowie Funeral Parlor. They passed each other going in opposite directions on Town Common Hill. Twitch and Gina had gone back inside, and the turnaround in front of the hospital's main doors was deserted. But she didn't stop there. Having a gun on the seat beside you made you wary. Phil would have said paranoid. She drove around back instead and parked in the employee's lot. She grabbed the .45, pushed it into the waistband of her jeans, and bloused her T-shirt over it. She walked across the lot and stopped at the laundry room door, reading the sign that said, "Smoking here will be banned as of January 1st. She looked at the doorknob and knew that if it didn't turn, she'd give this up. It would be a sign from God. If, on the other hand, the door was unlocked. It was. She slipped in, a pale and limping ghost. 3. Thurston Marshall was tired, exhausted, more like it, but happier than he had been in years. It was undoubtedly perverse. He was a tenured professor, a published poet, the editor of a prestigious literary magazine. He had a gorgeous young woman to share his bed, one who was smart and thought he was wonderful. That giving pills, slapping on salve, and emptying bedpans, not to mention wiping up the Bushy kid's beshitted bottom an hour ago, would make him happier than those things almost had to be perverse. And yet, there it was. The hospital corridors with their smells of disinfectant and floor polish connected him with his youth. The memories had been very clear tonight, from the pervasive aroma of patchouli oil in David Perna's apartment, to the paisley headband Thurst had worn to the candlelight memorial service for Bobby Kennedy. He went his rounds humming Big Leg Woman very softly under his breath. He peeped in the lounge and saw the nurse with the busted schnoz and the pretty little nurse's aide, Harriet, her name was, asleep on the cots that had been dragged in there. The couch was vacant, and soon he'd either catch a few hours rack time on it, or go back to the house on Highland Avenue that was now home. Probably back there. Strange developments. Strange world. First, though, one more check of what he was already thinking of as his patients. It wouldn't take long in this postage stamp of a hospital. Most of the rooms were empty anyway. Bill Allnut, who'd been forced to stay awake until 9 because of the injury he'd suffered in the Food City melee, was now fast asleep and snoring, turned on his side to take the pressure off the long laceration at the back of his head. Wanda Crumley was 2 doors down. The heart monitor was beeping and her BP was a little better, but she was on 5 liters of oxygen and Thurst feared she was a lost cause. Too much weight, too many cigarettes. Her husband and youngest daughter were sitting with her. Thurst gave Wendell Crumley a V for victory, which had been the peace sign in his salad days, and Wendell, smiling gamely, gave it back. Tansy Freeman, the appendectomy, was reading a magazine. "What's the fire whistle blowing for?" she asked him.
"Don't know, hon. How's your pain?"
"3, she said matter-of-factly. "Maybe a 2. Can I still go home tomorrow?"
"It's up to Dr. Rusty, but my crystal ball says yes."
And the way her face lit up at that made him feel, for no reason he could understand, like crying. "That baby's mom is back," Tansy said. "I saw her go by."
"Good,"
Thurst said, although the baby hadn't been much of a problem. He had cried once or twice, but mostly he slept, ate, or lay in his crib, staring apathetically up at the ceiling. His name was Walter. Thurst had no idea the little preceding it on the door card was an actual name, but Thurston Marshall thought of him as the Thorazine kid. Now he opened the door of room 23, the one with the yellow baby on board sign attached to it with a plastic sucker, and saw that the young woman, a rape victim, Gina had whispered to him, was sitting in the chair beside the bed. She had the baby in her lap and was feeding him a bottle.
"Are you all right?" Thurst glanced at the other name on the door card, "Ms. Boucher?"
He pronounced it Boucher, but Sammy didn't bother to correct him, or to tell him that boys had called her Bushy the Tushy,
Yes, doctor,
she said. Nor did Thirst bother to correct her misapprehension. That undefined joy, the kind that comes with tears hidden in it, swelled a little more. When he thought of how close he'd come to not volunteering, if Caro hadn't encouraged him, he would have missed this. Dr. Rusty will be glad you're back, and so is Walter. Do you need any pain medication?
No.
This was true. Her private still ached and throbbed, but that was far away. She felt as if she were floating above herself, tethered to earth by the thinnest of strings. Good. That means you're getting better.
Yes,
Sammy said.
Soon I'll be well.
When you finish feeding him, climb on into the bed, why don't you? Dr. Rusty will be in to check on you in the morning.
All right.
Good night, Miss Boucher.
Good night, doctor.
Thirst closed the door softly and continued down the hall. At the end of the corridor was the Rue girl's room. One peek in there, and then he'd call it a night. She was glassy but awake. The young man who'd been visiting her was not. He sat in the corner, snoozing in the room's only chair, with a sports magazine on his lap, and his long legs sprawled out in front of him. Georgia beckoned Thirst, and when he bent over her, she whispered something. Because of the low voice and her broken, mostly toothless mouth, he only got a word or two. He leaned closer.
Don't wake him.
To Thirst, she sounded like Homer Simpson.
He the only one who came to visit me.
Thirst nodded. Visiting hours were long over, of course, and given his blue shirt and his sidearm, the young man would probably be gigged for not responding to the fire whistle, but still, what harm? One firefighter more or less probably wouldn't make any difference. And if the guy was too far under for the sound of the whistle to wake him, he probably wouldn't be much help anyway. Thirst put a finger to his lips and blew the young woman a shh to show they were conspirators. She tried to smile, then winced. Thurston didn't offer her pain medication in spite of that. According to the chart at the end of the bed, she was maxed until 2 a.m. Instead, he just went out, closed the door softly behind him, and walked back down the sleeping hallway. He didn't notice that the door to the baby on board room was once more ajar. The couch in the lounge called to him seductively as he went by, but Thurston had decided to go back to Highland Avenue after all and check the kids. 4. Sammy sat by the bed with little Walter in her lap until the new doctor went by. Then she kissed her son on both cheeks and the mouth.
You be a good baby, she said. Mama's going to see you in heaven, if they let her in. I think they will. She's done her time in hell.
She laid him in his crib, then opened the drawer of the bed table. She had put the gun inside so little Walter wouldn't feel it poking into him while she held him and fed him for the last time. Now she took it out. 5. Lower Main Street was blocked off by nose-to-nose police cars with their jackpot lights flashing. A crowd, silent and unexcited, almost sullen, stood behind them, watching. Horace the Corgi was ordinarily a quiet dog, limiting his vocal repertoire to a volley of welcome home barks or the occasional yap to remind Julia he was still present and accounted for. But when she pulled over to the curb by Maison de Fleur, he let out a low howl from the back seat. Julia reached back blindly to stroke his head, taking comfort as much as giving it.
Julia, my God,
Rose said. They got out. Julia's original intention was to leave Horace behind, but when he uttered another of those small, bereft howls, as if he knew, as if he really knew. She fished under the passenger seat for his leash, opened the rear door for him to jump out, and then clipped the leash to his collar. She grabbed her personal camera, a pocket-sized Casio, from the seat pocket before closing the door. They pushed through the crowd of bystanders on the sidewalk, Horace leading the way, straining at his leash. Piper Libby's cousin, Roop, a part-time cop who'd come to the mill 5 years ago, tried to stop them. No one beyond this point, ladies.
That's my place, Julia said. Up top is everything I own in the world, clothes, books, personal possessions, the lot. Underneath is the newspaper my great-grandfather started.
It's only missed 4 press dates in over 120 years. Now it's going up in smoke. If you want to stop me from watching it happen at close range, you'll have to shoot me.
Roop looked unsure, but when she started forward again, Horace now at her knee and looking up at the balding man mistrustfully, Roop stood aside, but only momentarily. Not you, he told Rose.
Yes, me,
unless you want X-Lax in the next chocolate frap you order. Ma'am, Rose, I have my orders.
Devil take your orders, Julia said, with more weariness than defiance.
She took Rose by the arm and led her down the sidewalk, stopping only when she felt the shimmer against her face rise from preheat to bake. The Democrat was an inferno. The dozen or so cops weren't even trying to put it out, but they had plenty of Indian pumps, some still bearing stickers she could read easily in the firelight, another Burpee Sale Days special, and they were wetting down the drugstore and the bookstore. Given the windless conditions, Julia thought they might save both. And thus the rest of the business buildings on the east side of Maine.
Wonderful that they turned out so quick, Rose said.
Julia said nothing, only watched the flames whooshing up into the dark, blotting out the pink stars. She was too shocked to cry. Everything, she thought. Everything. Then she remembered the one bundle of newspapers she had tossed in her trunk before leaving to meet with Cox, and amended that to almost everything. Pete Freeman pushed through the ring of police who were currently dousing the front and north side of Sanders' hometown drug. The only clean spots on his face were where tears had cut through the soot.
Julia, I'm so sorry. He was nearly wailing. We almost had it stopped, would have had it stopped, but then the last bottle the bastards threw landed on the papers by the door and...
He wiped his remaining shirt sleeve across his face, smearing the soot there.
I'm so goddamn sorry.
She took him in her arms as if he were a baby, although Pete was 6 inches taller and outweighed her by 100 pounds. She hugged him, trying to mind his hurt arm, and said,
What happened?
Firebombs, he sobbed. That fucking Barbara.
He's in jail, Pete.
His friends, his goddamn friends, they did it.
What? You saw them?
Hurt him, he said, pulling back to look at her. Would have been hard not to. They had a bullhorn, said if Dale Barbara wasn't freed, they'd burn the whole town.
He grinned bitterly.
Free him? We ought to hang him. Give me a rope and I'll do it myself.
Big Jim came strolling up. The fire painted his cheeks orange. His eyes glittered. His smile was so wide that it stretched almost to his earlobes.
How do you like your friend Barbie now, Julia?
Julia stepped toward him, and there must have been something on her face because Big Jim fell back a step, as if afraid she might take a swing at him.
This makes no sense. None. And you know it.
Oh, I think it does. If you can bring yourself to consider the idea that Dale Barbara and his friends were the ones who set up the dome in the first place, I think it makes perfect sense. It was an act of terrorism. Pure and simple.
Bullshit. I was on his side, which means the newspaper was on his side. He knew that.
But they said... Pete began.
Yes, she said.
But she didn't look at him. Her eyes were still fixed on Rennie's violet face.
They said, but who the hell is they? Ask yourself that, Pete. Ask yourself this. If it wasn't Barbie who had no motive, then who did have a motive? Who benefits by shutting Julia Shumway's troublesome mouth?
Big Jim turned and motioned to two of the new officers, identifiable as cops only by the blue bandanas knotted around their biceps. One was a tall, hulking bruiser, whose face suggested he was still little more than a child, no matter his size. The other could only be a Killian. That bullet head was as distinctive as a commemorative stamp.
Mickey, Richie, get these two women off the scene.
Horace was crouched at the end of his leash, growling at Big Jim. Big Jim gave the little dog a contemptuous look.
And if they won't go voluntarily, you have my permission to pick them up and throw them over the hood of the nearest police car.
This isn't finished, Julia said, pointing a finger at him.
Now she was beginning to cry herself, but the tears were too hot and painful to be those of sorrow.
This isn't done, you son of a bitch.
Big Jim's smile reappeared. It was as shiny as the finish on his Hummer, and as black.
Yes, it is, he said. Done deal.
6. Big Jim started back toward the fire. He wanted to watch it until there was nothing left of the nosy Parker's newspaper but a pile of ashes, and swallowed a mouthful of smoke. His heart suddenly stopped in his chest, and the world seemed to go swimming past him like some kind of special effect. Then his ticker started again, but in a flurry of irregular beats that made him gasp. He slammed a fist against the left side of his chest and coughed hard, a quick fix for arrhythmia that Dr. Haskell had taught him. At first, his heart continued its irregular galloping, beat, pause, beat, 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 pause. But then it settled back to its normal rhythm. For just a moment, he saw it encased in a dense globule of yellow fat, like a living thing that has been buried alive and struggles to get free before the air is all gone. Then he pushed the image away. I'm all right, it's just overwork. Nothing 7 hours of sleep won't cure. Chief Randolph came over, an Indian pump strapped to his broad back. His face was running with sweat. Jim, you all right?
Fine, Big Jim said.
And he was. This was the high point of his life, his chance to achieve the greatness of which he knew he'd always been capable. No Dicky Ticker was going to take that away from him.
Just tired. I've been running pretty much nonstop.
Go home, Randolph advised. I never thought I'd say thank God for the dome, and I'm not saying it now, but at least it works as a windbreak. We're going to be all right. I've got men on the roofs of the drugstore and the bookstore in case any sparks jump, so go on and...
Which men?
His heartbeat smoothing out. Good. Henry Morrison and Toby Whalen on the bookstore. Georgie Frederick and one of those new kids on the drug. A Killian brat, I think. Romy Burpee volunteered to go up with him.
Got your walkie?
Of course I do.
And Frederick's got his?
All the regulars do.
Tell Frederick to keep an eye on Burpee.
Romy? Why, for Lord's sake?
I don't trust him. He could be a friend of Barbara's.
Although it wasn't Barbara Big Jim was worried about when it came to Burpee, the man had been a friend of Brenda's. And the man was sharp. Randolph's sweaty face was creased. How many do you think there are? How many on the son of a bitch's side? Big Jim shook his head.
Hard to say, Pete, but this thing is big. Must have been in the planning stages for a long time. You can't just look at the newbies in town and say it's got to be them. Some of the people in on it could have been here for years. Decades, even. It's what they call deep cover.
Christ, but why, Jim? Why, in God's name?
I don't know. Testing, maybe, with us for guinea pigs. Or maybe it's a power grab. I wouldn't put it past that thug in the White House. What matters is we're going to have to beef up security and watch for the liars trying to undermine our efforts to keep order.
Do you think she... He inclined his head toward Julia, who was watching her business go up in smoke with her dog sitting beside her, panting in the heat.
I don't know for sure, but the way she was this afternoon, storming around the station, yelling to see him... What does that tell you?
Yeah, Randolph said. He was looking at Julia Shumway with flat-eyed consideration. And burning up your own place, what better cover than that? Big Jim pointed a finger at him as if to say, you could have a bingo there.
I have to get off my feet. Get on the horn to George Frederick. Tell him to keep his good weather eye on that Lewiston Canuck.
All right. Randolph unclipped his walkie-talkie. Behind them, Fernald Bowie shouted, Roof's coming down! You on the street, stand back! You men on top of those other buildings, at the ready! At the ready!
Big Jim watched with one hand on the driver's door of his Hummer as the roof of the Democrat caved in, sending a gusher of sparks straight up into the black sky. The men posted on the adjacent buildings checked that their partners' Indian pumps were primed, and then stood at parade rest,
waiting for sparks with their nozzles in their hands. The expression on Shumway's face as the Democrat's roof let go did Big Jim's heart more good than all the cotton-picking medicines and pacemakers in the world. For years he had been forced to put up with her weekly tirades, and while he wouldn't admit he had been afraid of her, he surely had been annoyed. But look at her now, he thought. Looks like she came home and found her mother dead on the pot.
You look better, Randolph said. Your color's coming back.
I feel better, Big Jim said, but I'll still go home, grab some shut-eye.
That's a good idea, Randolph said. We need you, my friend, now more than ever. And if this dome thing doesn't go away...
He shook his head, his basset hound eyes never leaving Big Jim's face.
I don't know how we'd get along without you, put it that way. I love Andy Sanders like a brother, but he doesn't have much in the way of brains. And Andrea Grinnell hasn't been worth a tin shit since she fell and hurt her back. You're the glue that holds Chester's mill together.
Big Jim was moved by this. He gripped Randolph's arm and squeezed.
I'd give my life for this town. That's how much I love it.
I know. Me too.
But no one's going to steal it out from under us.
Got that right, Big Jim said. He drove away, mounting the sidewalk to get past the roadblock that had been placed at the north end of the business district. His heart was steady in his chest again. Well, almost. But he was troubled nonetheless. He'd have to see Everett. He didn't like the idea. Everett was another nosy Parker bent on causing trouble at a time when the town had to pull together. Also, he was no doctor. Big Jim would almost have felt better about trusting a vet with his medical problems, except there was none in town. He'd have to hope that if he needed medicine, something to regularize his heartbeat, Everett would know the right kind. Well, he thought, whatever he gives me, I can check it out with Andy. Yes, but that wasn't the biggest thing troubling him. It was something else Pete had said. If this dome thing doesn't go away... Big Jim wasn't worried about that. Quite the opposite. If the dome did go away. Too soon, that was. He could be in a fair spot of trouble even if the meth lab wasn't discovered. Certainly there would be cotton pickers who would second-guess his decisions. One of the rules of political life that he'd grasped early was, those who can do, those who can't question the decisions of those who can. They might not understand that everything he'd done or ordered done, even the rock throwing at the market this morning, had been of a caretaking nature. Barbara's friends on the outside would be especially prone to misunderstanding, because they would not want to understand. That Barbara had friends, powerful ones, on the outside was a thing Big Jim hadn't questioned, since seeing that letter from the president. But for the time being, they could do nothing, which was the way Big Jim wanted it to stay for at least a couple of weeks, maybe even a month or two. The truth was, he liked the dome. Not for the long term, of course, but until the propane out there at the radio station was redistributed, until the lab was dismantled and the supply barn that had housed it had been burned to the ground, another crime to be laid at the door of Dale Barbara's co-conspirators. Until Barbara could be tried and executed by police firing squad. Until any blame for how things were done during the crisis could be spread around to as many people as possible, and the credit accrued to just one, namely himself. Until then, the dome was just fine. Big Jim decided he'd get knee-bound and pray on it before turning in. 7. Sammy limped down the hospital corridor looking at the names on the doors and checking behind those with no names just to be sure. She was starting to worry that the bitch wasn't here when she came to the last one and saw a get-well card thumbtacked there. It showed a cartoon dog saying, "I heard you weren't feeling so well." Sammy drew Jack Evans' gun from the waistband of her jeans. That waistband a little looser now. She'd finally managed to lose some weight, better late than never, and use the automatic's muzzle to open the card. On the inside, the cartoon dog was licking his balls and saying, "Need a hind lick maneuver?" It was signed Mel, Jim Jr.,
Carter, and Frank, and was exactly the sort of tasteful greeting Sammy would have expected of them. She pushed the door open with the barrel of the gun. Georgia wasn't alone. This did not disturb the deep calm that Sammy felt, the sense of peace nearly attained. It might have if the man sleeping in the corner had been an innocent, the bitch's father or uncle, say, but it was Frankie, the tit-grabber. The one who'd raped her first, telling her she'd better learn to keep her mouth for when she was on her knees. That he was sleeping didn't change anything, because guys like him always woke up and recommenced their fuckery. Georgia wasn't asleep. She was in too much pain. And the long hair who'd come in to check her hadn't offered her any more dope. She saw Sammy and her eyes widened.
"You," she said. "Get out of here."
Sammy smiled.
"You sound like Homer Simpson," she said.
Georgia saw the gun, and her eyes widened. She opened her now mostly toothless mouth and screamed. Sammy continued to smile. The smile widened, in fact. The scream was music to her ears and balm to her hurts.
"Do that, bitch," she said. "Right, Georgia? Isn't that what you said, you heartless cunt?"
Frank woke up and stared around in wide-eyed befuddlement. His ass had migrated all the way to the edge of his chair, and when Georgia shrieked again, he jerked and fell onto the floor. He was wearing a sidearm now, they all were, and he grabbed for it, saying, "Put it down, Sammy, just put it down, we're all friends here, let's be friends here." Sammy said,
"You ought to keep your mouth closed except for when you're on your knees gobbling your friend Junior's cock."
Then she pulled the Springfield's trigger. The blast from the automatic was deafening in the small room. The first shot went over Frankie's head and shattered the window. Georgia screamed again. She was trying to get out of bed now, her IV line and monitor wires popping free. Sammy shoved her, and she flopped askew on her back. Frankie still didn't have his gun out. In his fear and confusion, he was tugging at the holster instead of the weapon and succeeding at nothing but yanking his belt up on the right side. Sammy took two steps toward him, grasped the pistol in both hands like she'd seen people do on TV, and fired again. The left side of Frankie's head came off. A flap of scalp struck the wall and stuck there. He clapped his hand to the wound. Blood sprayed through his fingers. Then his fingers were gone, sinking into the oozing sponge where his skull had been. "No more," he cried. His eyes were huge and swimming with tears. "No more, don't hurt me." And then, "Mom, Mommy."
"Don't bother, your mommy didn't raise you right,"
Sammy said, and shot him again, this time in the chest. He jumped against the wall. His hand left his wrecked head and thumped to the floor, splashing in the pool of blood that was already forming there. She shot him a third time, in the place that had hurt her. Then she turned to the one on the bed. Georgia was huddled in a ball. The monitor above her was beeping like crazy, probably because she'd pulled out the wires connected to it. Her hair hung in her eyes. She screamed and screamed.
"Isn't that what you said?"
Sammy asked.
"Do that, bitch, right?"
"Hey, hurry."
"What?"
Georgia tried again.
I hurry, Hammy."
And then, the ultimate absurdity,
"I take it back."
"You can't."
Sammy shot Georgia in the face and again in the neck. Georgia jumped the way Frankie had, then lay still. Sammy heard running footsteps and shouts in the corridor. Sleepy cries of concern from some of the rooms as well. She was sorry about causing a fuss, but sometimes there was just no choice. Sometimes things had to be done, and when they were, there could be peace. She put the gun to her temple.
"I love you, little Walter. Mama loves her boy."
And pulled the trigger. 8. Rusty used West Street to get around the fire, then hooked back onto Lower Main at the 117 intersection. Bowie's was dark, except for small electric candles in the front windows. He drove around back to the smaller lot as his wife had instructed him, and parked beside the long gray Cadillac hearse. Somewhere close by, a generator was clattering. He was reaching for the door handle when his phone twittered. He turned it off without looking to see who might be calling, and when he looked up again, a cop was standing beside his window. A cop with a drawn gun. It was a woman. When she bent down, Rusty saw a cloudburst of frizzy blonde hair, and at last had a face to go with the name his wife had mentioned. The police dispatcher and receptionist on the day shift. Rusty assumed she had been pressed into full-time service on or just after Dome Day. He also assumed that her current duty assignment had been self-assigned. She holstered the pistol.
Hey, Dr. Rusty. Stacy Moggin. You treated me for poison oak 2 years ago? You know, on my...
She patted her behind. I remember. Nice to see you with your pants up, Ms. Moggin. She laughed as she had spoken, softly.
Hope I didn't scare you.
A little. I was silencing my cell phone, and then there you were.
Sorry. Come on inside. Linda's waiting. We don't have much time. I'm going to stand watch out front. I'll give Lynn a double click on her walkie if someone comes. If it's the Bowies, they'll park in the side lot, and we can drive out on East Street unnoticed.
She cocked her head a little and smiled.
Well, that's a tad optimistic, but at least unidentified. If we're lucky.
Rusty followed her, navigating by the cloudy beacon of her hair. Did you break in, Stacy?
Hell no. There was a key at the cop shop. Most of the businesses on Main Street give us keys.
And why are you in on this?
Because it's all fear-driven bullshit. Duke Perkins would have put a stop to it long ago. Now come on and make this fast.
I can't promise that. In fact, I can't promise anything. I'm not a pathologist.
Fast as you can, then.
Rusty followed her inside. A moment later, Linda's arms were around him. 9. Harriet Bigelow screamed twice, then fainted. Gina Bufalino only stared, glassy with shock.
Get Gina out of here, Thirst snapped.
He had gotten as far as the parking lot, heard the shots, and come running back. To find this slaughter. Ginny put an arm around Gina's shoulders and led her back into the hall where the patients who were ambulatory, this included Bill Allnut and Tansy Freeman, were standing, big-eyed and frightened.
Get this one out of the way, Thirst told Twitch, pointing at Harriet, and pull her skirt down. Give the poor girl some modesty.
Twitch did as he was told. When he and Ginny re-entered the room, Thirst was kneeling by the body of Frank DeLesseps, who had died because he'd come in place of George's boyfriend and overstayed visiting hours. Thirst had flapped the sheet over Georgia, and it was already blooming with blood poppies.
Is there anything we can do, Doctor?
Ginny asked. She knew he wasn't a doctor, but in her shock it came automatically. She was looking down at Frank's sprawled body, and her hand was over her mouth.
Yes.
Thirst rose, and his bony knees cracked like pistol shots.
Call the police. This is a crime scene.
All the ones on duty will be fighting that fire down street, Twitch said. Those who aren't will either be on their way or sleeping with their phones turned off.
We'll call somebody for the love of Jesus and find out if we're supposed to do anything before we clean up the mess. Take photographs or I don't know what. Not that there's much doubt about what happened. You'll have to excuse me for a minute. I'm going to vomit.
Ginny stood aside so Thurston could go into the tiny WC attached to the room. He closed the door, but the sound of his retching was still loud. The sound of a revving engine with dirt caught in it somewhere. Ginny felt a wave of faintness rush through her head, seeming to lift her and make her light. She fought it off. When she looked back at Twitch, he was just closing his cell phone.
No answer from Rusty, he said. I left a voicemail. Anyone else? What about Rennie?
No, she almost shuddered. Not him.
My sister? Andy, I mean.
Ginny only looked at him. Twitch looked back for a moment, then dropped his eyes.
Maybe not, he mumbled.
Ginny touched him above the wrist. His skin was cold with shock. She supposed her own was, too.
If it's any comfort, she said, I think she's trying to get clean. She came to see Rusty, and I'm pretty sure that was what it was about.
Twitch ran his hands down the side of his face, turning it for a moment into an opera bouffe mask of sorrow.
This is a nightmare.
Yes, Ginny said simply.
Then she took out her cell phone again. Who are you going to call? Twitch managed a little smile. Ghostbusters?
No, if Andy and Big Jim are out, who does that leave?
Sanders, but he's dog shit useless and you know it. Why don't we just clean up the mess? Thurston's right. What happened here is obvious.
Thurston came out of the bathroom. He was wiping his mouth with a paper towel.
Because there are rules, young man, and under the circumstances, it's more important than ever that we follow them. Or at least, give it the good old college try.
Twitch looked up and saw Sammy Bushy's brains drying high on one wall. What she had used to think with now looked like a clot of oatmeal. He burst into tears. 10. Andy Sanders was sitting in Dale Barbara's apartment, on the side of Dale Barbara's bed. The window was filled with orange fire glare from the burning Democrat building next door. From above him he heard footsteps and muffled voices. Men on the roof, he assumed. He had brought a brown bag with him when he climbed the inside staircase from the pharmacy below. Now he took out the contents. A glass, a bottle of Dasani water, and a bottle of pills. The pills were OxyContin tablets. The label read, Hold for A. Grinnell. They were pink, the 20s. He shook some out, counted, then shook out more. 20. 400 milligrams. It might not be enough to kill Andrea, who'd had time to build up a tolerance, but he was sure it would do quite well for him. The heat from the fire next door came baking through the wall. His skin was wet with sweat. It had to be at least 100 in here, maybe more. He wiped his face with the coverlet. Won't feel it much longer. There'll be cool breezes in heaven, and we'll all sit down to dinner together at the Lord's table. He used the bottom of the glass to grind the pink pills into powder, making sure the dope would hit him all at once. Like a hammer on a steer's head. Just lie down on the bed, close his eyes, and then good night, sweet pharmacist. May flights of angels sing me to thy rest. Me and Claudie, and Dodie, together for eternity. Don't think so, brother. That was Coggins' voice. Coggins at his most dour and declamatory. Andy paused in the act of crushing the pills. Suicides don't eat supper with their loved ones, my friend. They go to hell, and dine on hot coals that burn forever in the belly. Can you give me hallelujah on that? Can you say amen? Bull spit, Andy whispered, and went back to grinding the pills. You were snout first in the trough with the rest of us. Why should I believe you? Because I speak the truth. Your wife and daughter are looking down on you right now, pleading with you not to do it. Can't you hear them? Nope, Andy said. And that's not you either. It's just the part of my mind that's cowardly. It's run me my whole life. It's how Big Jim got hold of me. It's how I got into this meth mess. I didn't need the money. I don't even understand that much money. I just didn't know how to say no. But I can say it this time. No, sir, I've got nothing left to live for, and I'm leaving. Got anything to say to that? It seemed that Lester Coggins did not. Andy finished reducing the pills to powder, then filled the glass with water. He brushed the pink dust into the glass using the side of his hand, then stirred with his finger. The only sounds were the fire and the dim shouts of the men fighting it, and from above, the thump, thud, thump of other men walking around on his roof. Down the hatch, he said, but didn't drink. His hand was on the glass, but that cowardly part of him, that part that didn't want to die even though any meaningful life was over, held it where it was. No, you don't win this time, he said. But he let go of the glass so he could wipe his streaming face with the coverlet again. Not every time. Not this time. He raised the glass to his lips. Sweet pink oblivion swam inside. But again, he put it down on the bed table. The cowardly part still ruling him. God damn that cowardly part. Lord, send me a sign, he whispered. Send me a sign that it's all right to drink this, if for no other reason than because it's the only way I can get out of this town. Next door, the roof of the Democrat went down in a stew of sparks. Above him, someone
it sounded like Romeo Burpee, shouted, "Be ready, boys. Be on the goddamn ready." Be ready. That was the sign, surely. Andy Sanders lifted the glassful of death again, and this time the cowardly part didn't hold his arm down. The cowardly part seemed to have given up. In his pocket, his cell phone played the opening phrases of "You're Beautiful," a sentimental piece of crap that had been Claudie's choice. For a moment he almost drank, anyway, but then a voice whispered that this could be a sign, too. He couldn't tell if that was the voice of the cowardly part, or of Coggins, or of his own true heart, and because he couldn't, he answered the phone.
"Mr. Sanders?"
A woman's voice. Tired and unhappy and frightened, Andy could relate.
"This is Virginia Tomlinson up at the hospital?"
"Jenny, sure." Sounding like his old, cheery, helpful self, it was bizarre.
"We have a situation here, I'm afraid. Can you come?"
Light pierced the confused darkness in Andy's head. It filled him with amazement and gratitude. To have someone say, "Can you come?" Had he forgotten how fine that felt? He supposed he had, although it was why he'd stood for selectmen in the first place. Not to wield power, that was Big Jim's thing, only to lend a helping hand. That was how he'd started out. Maybe it was how he could finish up.
"Mr. Sanders, are you there?"
"Yes. You hang in, Ginny. I'll be right there." He paused. "And none of that Mr. Sanders stuff. It's Andy. We're all in this together, you know." He hung up, took the glass into the bathroom, and poured its pink contents into the commode. His good feeling, that feeling of light and amazement, lasted until he pushed the flush lever. Then depression settled over him again like a smelly old coat. Needed? That was pretty funny. He was just stupid old Andy Sanders, the dummy who sat on Big Jim's lap, the mouthpiece, the gabbler, the man who read Big Jim's motions and proposals as if they were his own, the man who came in handy every 2 years or so, electioneering and laying on the corn-pone charm, things of which Big Jim was either incapable or unwilling. There were more pills in the bottle. There was more Dasani in the cooler downstairs. But Andy didn't seriously consider these things. He had made Ginny Tomlinson a promise, and he was a man who kept his word. But suicide hadn't been rejected, only put on the back burner. Tabled, as they said in the small-town political biz. And it would be good to get out of this bedroom, which had almost been his death chamber. It was filling up with smoke. 11. The Bowie's mortuary workroom was below ground, and Linda felt safe enough turning on the lights. Rusty needed them for his examination. "Look at this mess," he said, waving an arm at the dirty, foot-tracked tile floor, the beer and soft drink cans on the counters, an open trash can in one corner with a few flies buzzing over it. "If the State Board of Funeral Service saw this, or the Department of Health, it'd be shut down in a New York minute." "We're not in New York," Linda reminded him. She was looking at the stainless steel table in the center of the room. The surface was cloudy with substances probably best left unnamed, and there was a balled-up Snickers wrapper in one of the runoff gutters. "We're not even in Maine anymore, I don't think. Hurry up, Eric, this place stinks." "In more ways than one," Rusty said. The mess offended him. Hell outraged him. He could have punched Stuart Bowie in the mouth just for the candy wrapper, discarded on the table where the town's dead had the blood drained from their bodies. On the far side of the room were six stainless steel body lockers. From somewhere behind them, Rusty could hear the steady rumble of refrigeration equipment. "No shortage of propane here," he muttered. "The Bowie brothers are living large in the hood." There were no names in the card slots on the fronts of the lockers, another sign of sloppiness, so Rusty pulled the whole six-pack. The first two were empty, which didn't surprise him. Most of those who had so far died under the dome, including Ron Haskell and the Evanses, had been buried quickly. Jimmy Saroy, with no close relatives, was still in the small morgue at Kathy Russell. The next four contained the bodies he had come to see. The smell of decomposition bloomed as soon as he pulled out the rolling racks. It overwhelmed the unpleasant but less aggressive smells of preservatives and funeral ointments. Linda retreated farther, gagging.
"Don't you vomit, Linny," Rusty said, and went across to the cabinets on the far side of the room.
The first drawer he opened contained nothing but stacked back issues of Field and Stream, and he cursed. The one under it, however, had what he needed. He reached beneath a trocar that looked as if it had never been washed, and pulled out a pair of green plastic face masks still in their wrappers. He handed one mask to Linda, donned the other himself. He looked into the next drawer and appropriated a pair of rubber gloves. They were bright yellow, hellishly jaunty.
If you think you're going to throw up in spite of the mask, go upstairs with Stacy.
I'll be all right. I should witness.
I'm not sure how much your testimony would count for you. You're my wife, after all.
She repeated, I should witness. Just be as quick as you can. The body racks were filthy. This didn't surprise him after seeing the rest of the prep area, but it still disgusted him. Linda had thought to bring an old cassette recorder she'd found in the garage. Rusty pushed record, tested the sound, and was mildly surprised to find it was not too bad. He placed the little Panasonic on one of the empty racks. Then he pulled on the gloves. It took longer than it should have. His hands were sweating. There was probably talcum or Johnson's baby powder here somewhere, but he had no intention of wasting time looking for it. He already felt like a burglar. Hell, he was a burglar.
Okay, here we go. It's 10:45 p.m., October 24th. This examination is taking place in the prep room of the Bowie funeral home, which is filthy, by the way, shameful. I see four bodies, three women and a man. Two of the women are young, late teens or early 20s. Those are Angela McCain and Dodie Sanders.
Dorothy, Linda said from the far side of the prep table. Her name was Dorothy.
I stand corrected. Dorothy Sanders, the third woman, is in late middle age. That's Brenda Perkins. The man is about 40. He's the Reverend Lester Coggins. For the record, I can identify all these people.
He beckoned his wife and pointed at the bodies. She looked and her eyes welled with tears. She raised the mask long enough to say,
I'm Linda Everett of the Chester's Mill Police Department. My badge number is 775. I also recognize these four bodies.
She put her mask back in place.
Above it, her eyes pleaded.
Rusty motioned her back. It was all a charade anyway. He knew it, and guessed Linda did too. Yet he didn't feel depressed. He had wanted a medical career ever since boyhood, would certainly have been a doctor if he hadn't had to leave school to take care of his parents, and what had driven him as a high school sophomore dissecting frogs and cow's eyes in biology class was what drove him now. Simple curiosity. The need to know. And he would know. Maybe not everything, but at least some things. This is where the dead help the living. Did Linda say that? Didn't matter. He was sure they would help if they could.
There has been no cosmeticizing of the bodies that I can see, but all four have been embalmed. I don't know if the process has been completed, but I suspect not, because the femoral artery taps are still in place. Angela and Dorothy, have been badly beaten and are well into decomposition. Coggins has also been beaten, savagely from the look, and is also into decomp, although not as far. The musculature on his face and arms has just begun to sag. Brenda Perkins. He trailed off and bent over her.
Rusty?
Linda asked nervously.
Honey?
He reached out a gloved hand, thought better of it, removed the glove, and cupped her throat. Then he lifted Brenda's head and felt the grotesquely large knot just below the nape. He eased her head down, then rotated her body onto one hip, so he could look at her back and buttocks.
Jesus,
he said.
Rusty, what?
For one thing, she's still caked with shit, he thought. But that wouldn't go on the record. Not even if Randolph or Rennie only listened to the first 60 seconds before crushing the tape under a shoe heel and burning whatever remained. He would not add that detail of her defilement. But he would remember.
What?
He wet his lips and said,
Brenda Perkins shows liver mortis on the buttocks and thighs, indicating she's been dead at least 12 hours, probably more like 14. There's significant bruising on both cheeks. They're handprints. There's no doubt in my mind of that.
Someone took hold of her face and snapped her head hard to the left. fracturing the atlas and axis cervical vertebrae C1 and C2. Probably severed her spine as well.
Oh, Rusty,
Linda moaned. Rusty thumbed up first one of Brenda's eyelids, then the other. He saw what he had feared. Bruising to the cheeks and scleral petechiae. Blood spots in the whites of this woman's eyes. Suggest death wasn't instantaneous. She was unable to draw breath and asphyxiated. She may or may not have been conscious. We'll hope not. That's all I can tell, unfortunately. The girls, Angela and Dorothy, have been dead the longest. The state of decomposition suggests they were stored in a warm place. He snapped off the recorder. In other words, I see nothing that absolutely exonerates Barbie and nothing we didn't goddamn know already.
What if his hands don't match the bruises on Brenda's face?
The marks are too diffuse to be sure. Lynn, I feel like the stupidest man on earth. He rolled the two girls, who should have been cruising the Auburn Mall, pricing earrings, buying clothes at Deb, comparing boyfriends, back into darkness. Then he turned to Brenda.
Give me a cloth. I saw some stacked beside the sink.
They even look clean, which is sort of a miracle in this pigsty.
What are you... Just give me a cloth. Better make it two. Wet them. Do we have time to...
We're going to make time. Linda watched silently as her husband carefully washed Brenda Perkins' buttocks and the backs of her thighs. When he was done, he flung the dirty rags into the corner, thinking that if the Bowie brothers had been here, he would have stuffed one into Stewart's mouth and the other into fucking Fernald's. He kissed Brenda on her cool brow and rolled her back into the refrigerated locker. He started to do the same with Coggins, then stopped. The Reverend's face had been given only the most cursory of cleanings. There was still blood in his ears, his nostrils, and grimed into his brow.
Linda, wet another cloth. Honey, it's been almost 10 minutes. I love you for showing respect to the dead, but we've got the living to...
We may have something here. This wasn't the same kind of beating. I can see that even without...
Wet a cloth.
She made no further argument, only wet another cloth, wrung it out, and handed it to him. Then she watched as he cleansed the remaining blood from the dead man's face, working gently, but without the love he'd shown Brenda. She had been no fan of Lester Coggins, who had once claimed on his weekly radio broadcast that kids who went to see Miley Cyrus were risking hell. But what Rusty was uncovering still hurt her heart.
My God, he looks like a scarecrow after a bunch of kids used rocks on it for target practice.
I told you, not the same kind of beating. This wasn't done with fists, or even feet. Linda pointed.
What's that on his temple?
Rusty didn't answer. Above his mask, his eyes were bright with amazement. Something else, too. Understanding, just starting to dawn.
What is it, Eric? It looks like, I don't know, what, stitches?
You bet.
His mask bobbed as the mouth beneath it broke into a smile. Not happiness. Satisfaction, and of the grimmest kind. On his forehead, too, see, and his jaw. That one broke his jaw.
What sort of weapon leaves marks like that?
A baseball, Rusty said, rolling the drawer shut. Not an ordinary one, but one that was gold-plated? Yes, if swung with enough force, I think it could. I think it did. He lowered his forehead to hers. Their masks bumped. He looked into her eyes. Jim Rennie has one. I saw it on his desk when I went to talk to him about the missing propane. I don't know about the others, but I think we know where Lester Coggins died. And who killed him. 12. After the roof collapsed, Julia couldn't bear to watch anymore.
Come home with me, Rose said. The guest room is yours as long as you want it. Thanks, but no. I need to be by myself now, Rosie. Well, you know, with Horace. I need to think.
Where will you stay? Will you be all right?
Yes.
Not knowing if she would be or not. Her mind seemed okay. Thinking processes all in order. But she felt as if someone had given her emotions a big shot of Novocaine.
Maybe I'll come by later.
When Rosie was gone, walking up the other side of the street, and turning to give Julia a final troubled wave. Julia went back to the Prius, ushered Horace into the front seat, then got behind the wheel. She looked for Pete Freeman and Tony Gay and didn't see them anywhere. Maybe Tony had taken Pete up to the hospital to get some salve for his arm. It was a miracle neither of them had been hurt worse. And if she hadn't taken Horace with her when she drove out to see Cox, her dog would have been incinerated along with everything else. When that thought came, she realized her emotions weren't numb after all, but only hiding. A sound, a kind of keening, began to come from her. Horace pricked up his considerable ears and looked at her anxiously. She tried to stop, and couldn't. Her father's paper. Her grandfather's paper. Her great-grandfather's. Ashes. She drove down to West Street, and when she came to the abandoned parking lot behind the Globe, she pulled in. She turned off the engine, drew Horace to her, and wept against one furry, muscular shoulder for 5 minutes. To his credit, Horace bore this patiently. When she was cried out, she felt better. Calmer. Perhaps it was the calmness of shock, but at least she could think again. And what she thought of was the one remaining bundle of papers in the trunk. She leaned past Horace, who gave her neck a companionable lick, and opened the glove compartment. It was jammed with rickrack, but she thought somewhere, just possibly, and like a gift from God, there it was. A little plastic box filled with pushpins, rubber bands, thumbtacks, and paperclips. Rubber bands and paperclips would be no good for what she had in mind but the tacks and pushpins.
"Horace," she said, "do you want to go walkie-walk?"
Horace barked that he did indeed want to go walkie-walk.
"Good," she said. "So do I."
She got the newspapers, then walked back to Main Street. The Democrat building was now just a blazing heap of rubble with cops pouring on the water. From those oh-so-convenient Indian pumps, she thought, all loaded up and ready to go. Looking at it hurt Julia's heart, of course it did, but not so badly, now that she had something to do. She walked down the street with Horace pacing in state beside her, and on every telephone pole she put up a copy of the Democrats' last issue. The headline, "Riot and Murders as Crisis Deepens," seemed to glare out in the light of the fire. She wished now she had settled for a single word. Beware. She went on until they were all gone. 13. Across the street, Peter Randolph's walkie-talkie crackled 3 times. Break, break, break. Urgent. Dreading what he might hear, he thumbed the transmit button and said, "Chief Randolph, go." It was Freddie Denton, who, as commanding officer of the night shift, was now the de facto assistant chief.
"Just got a call from the hospital, Pete. Double murder."
"What?" Randolph screamed. One of the new officers, Mickey Wardlaw, was gawking at him like a Mongolian ejit at his first county fair. Denton continued, sounding either calm or smug. If it was the latter, God help him.
"And a suicide. Shooter was that girl who cried rape. Victims were ours, Chief. Rue and De Lesseps."
"You are shitting me." "I sent Rupe and Mel Searles up there," Freddie said. "Bright side, it's all over and we don't have to jug her down in the coop with Barb." "You should have gone yourself, Fred. You're the senior officer."
"Then who'd be on the desk?"
Randolph had no answer for that. It was either too smart or too stupid. He supposed he'd better get his ass up to Kathy Russell. "I no longer want this job. No. Not even a little bit." But it was too late now. And with Big Jim to help him, he'd manage. That was the thing to concentrate on. Big Jim would see him through. Marty Arsenault tapped his shoulder. Randolph almost hauled off and hit him. Arsenault didn't notice. He was looking across the street to where Julia Shumway was walking her dog. Walking her dog and... what? Putting up newspapers. That was what. Tacking them to the goddamn Christing telephone poles. "That bitch won't quit," he breathed.
"Want me to go over there and make her quit?" Arsenault asked.
Marty looked eager for the chore, and Randolph almost gave it to him. Then he shook his head.
she'd just start giving you an earful about her damn civil rights. Like she doesn't realize that scaring the holy hell out of everyone isn't exactly in the town's best interest. He shook his head. Probably she doesn't. She's incredibly... There was a word for what she was, a French word he'd learned in high school. He didn't expect it to come to him, but it did. Incredibly naive. I'll stop her, Chief, I will. What's she gonna do, call a lawyer? Let her have her fun, at least it's keeping her out of our hair. I better go up to the hospital. Denton says the bushy girl murdered Frank de Lesseps and Georgia Rue. Then killed herself. Christ, Marty whispered, his face losing its color. Is that down to Barbara, too, do you think? Randolph started to say it wasn't, then reconsidered. His second thought was of the girl's rape accusation. Her suicide gave it a ring of truth, and rumors that mill police officers could have done such a thing would be bad for department morale, and hence for the town. He didn't need Jim Rennie to tell him that. Don't know, he said, but it's possible. Marty's eyes were watering, either from smoke or from grief. Maybe both. Gotta get Big Jim on top of this, Pete. I will. Meanwhile, Randolph nodded toward Julia, keep an eye on her, and when she finally gets tired and goes away, take all that shit down and toss it where it belongs. He indicated the torch that had been a newspaper office earlier in the day. Put litter in its place. Marty snickered. Roger that, boss. And that was just what Officer Arsenault did. But not before others in town had taken down a few of the papers for perusal in brighter light. Half a dozen. Maybe 10. They were passed from hand to hand in the next 2 or 3 days, and read until they quite literally fell apart. 14. When Andy got to the hospital, Piper Libby was already there. She was sitting on a bench in the lobby talking to 2 girls in the white nylon pants and smock tops of nurses, although to Andy they seemed far too young to be real nurses. Both had been crying and looked like they might start again soon, but Andy could see Reverend Libby was having a calming effect on them. One thing he'd never had a problem with was judging human emotions. Sometimes he wished he'd been better at the thinking side of things. Ginny Tomlinson was standing nearby, conversing quietly with an oldish-looking fellow. Both looked dazed and shaken. Ginny saw Andy and came over. The oldish-looking fellow trailed along behind. She introduced him as Thurston Marshall and said he was helping out. Andy gave the new fellow a big smile and a warm handshake.
Nice to meet you, Thurston. I'm Andy Sanders, first selectman.
Piper glanced over from the bench and said,
If you were really the first selectman, Andy, you'd rein in the second selectman.
I understand you've had a hard couple of days, Andy said, still smiling. We all have.
Piper gave him a look of singular coldness, then asked the girls if they wouldn't like to come down to the caf with her and have tea.
I could sure use a cup, she said. I called her after I called you, Ginny said, a little apologetically, after Piper had led the 2 junior nurses away. And I called the PD, got Fred Denton.
She wrinkled her nose as people do when they smell something bad.
Aw, oh, Freddy's a good guy, Andy said earnestly.
His heart was in none of this. His heart felt like it was still back on Dale Barbara's bed, planning to drink the poisoned pink water. But the old habits kicked in smoothly, nevertheless. The urge to make things all right, to calm troubled waters, turned out to be like riding a bicycle.
Tell me what happened here.
She did so. Andy listened with surprising calmness, considering he'd known the de Lesseps family all his life, and had in high school once taken Georgia Rue's mother on a date. Helen had kissed with her mouth open, which was nice, but had stinky breath, which wasn't. He thought his current emotional flatness had everything to do with knowing that if his phone hadn't rung when it did, he'd be unconscious by now. Maybe dead. A thing like that put the world in perspective.
2 of our brand new officers, he said.
To himself, he sounded like the recording you got when you called a movie theater to get showtimes.
1 already badly hurt trying to clean up that supermarket mess. Dear, dear.
This is probably not the time to say so, but I'm not very fond of your police department, Thurston said.
although since the officer who actually punched me is now dead, lodging a complaint would be moot.
Which officer, Frank or the Rue girl?
The young man. I recognized him in spite of his mortal disfigurement.
Frank the Lesseps punched you?
Andy simply didn't believe this. Frankie had delivered his Lewiston son for 4 years and never missed a day. Well, yes, one or two, now that he thought of it, but those had come during big snowstorms. And once he'd had the measles. Or had it been the mumps? If that was his name.
Well, gosh, that's...
It was what? And did it matter? Did anything? Yet Andy pushed gamely forward.
That's regrettable, sir. We believe in living up to our responsibilities in Chester's Mill, doing the right thing. It's just that right now we're kind of under the gun, circumstances beyond our control, you know.
I do know, Thirst said. As far as I'm concerned, it's water over the dam. But, sir, those officers were awfully young, and very out of line. He paused. The lady I'm with was also assaulted. Andy just couldn't believe this fellow was telling the truth. Chester's Mill cops didn't hurt people unless they were provoked, severely provoked. That was for the big cities, where folks didn't know how to get along. Of course, he would have said a girl killing two cops and then taking her own life was also the kind of thing that didn't happen in the mill.
Never mind, Andy thought. He's not just an out-of-towner, he's an out-of-stater.
Put it down to that.
Ginny said, Now that you're here, Andy, I'm not sure what you can do. Twitch is taking care of the bodies, and...
Before she could go on, the door opened. A young woman came in, leading two sleepy-looking children by the hands. The old fellow, Thurston, hugged her, while the children, a girl and a boy, looked on. Both of them were barefooted and wearing T-shirts as nightshirts. The boys, which came all the way down to his ankles, read Prisoner 9091 and Property of Shawshank State Prison. Thurston's daughter and grandchildren, Andy supposed, and that made him miss Claudette and Doty all over again. He pushed the thought of them away. Ginny had called him for help, and it was clear she needed some herself, which would no doubt mean listening while she told the whole story again, not for his benefit, but for her own, so she could get the truth of it and start making peace with it. Andy didn't mind. Listening was a thing he'd always been good at, and it was better than looking at three dead bodies, one the discarded husk of his old paperboy. Listening was such a simple thing, when you got right down to it. Even a moron could listen. But Big Jim had never gotten the hang of it. Big Jim was better at talking, and planning, that too. They were lucky to have him at a time like this. As Ginny was winding up her second recitation, a thought came to Andy, possibly an important one.
Has anyone...
Thurston returned with the newcomers in tow.
Selectman Sanders, Andy, this is my partner, Carolyn Sturges, and these are the children we're taking care of, Alice and Aiden.
I want my binky,
Aiden said morosely.
Alice said, You're too old for a binky, and elbowed him.
Aiden's face scrunched, but he didn't quite cry.
Alice, Carolyn Sturges said, that's mean. And what do we know about mean people?
Alice brightened.
Mean people suck, she cried, and collapsed into giggles.
After considering a moment, Aiden joined her.
I'm sorry, Carolyn said to Andy. I had no one to watch them, and Thirst sounded so distraught when he called.
It was hard to believe, but it seemed possible the old guy was bumping sweet spots with the young lady. The idea was only of passing interest to Andy, although under other circumstances he might have considered it deeply, pondering positions, wondering about whether she Frenched him with that dewy mouth of hers, etc., etc. Now, however, he had other things on his mind.
Has anyone told Sammy's husband that she's dead?
He asked.
Phil Bushy?
It was Dougie Twitchell coming down the hall and into the reception area. His shoulders were slumped and his complexion was gray.
Son of a bitch left her and left town months ago.
His eyes fell on Alice and Aiden Appleton.
Sorry, kids.
That's all right, Carol said. We have an open language house. It's much more truthful.
That's right, Alice piped up. We can say shit and piss all we want, at least until Ma gets back. But not bitch, Aiden amplified. Bitch is exist.
Carol took no notice of this byplay.
Thurs, what happened?
Not in front of the kids, he said. Open language or no open language.
Frank's parents are out of town, Twitch said, but I got in touch with Helen Rue. She took it quite calmly.
Drunk? Andy asked.
As a skunk.
Andy wandered a little way up the hall. A few patients clad in hospital johnnies and slippers were standing with their backs to him, looking at the scene of the slaughter, he presumed. He had no urge to do likewise and was glad Dougie Twitchell had taken care of whatever needed taken care of. He was a pharmacist and a politician. His job was to help the living, not process the dead. And he knew something these people did not. He couldn't tell them that Phil Bushy was still in town, living like a hermit out at the radio station, but he could tell Phil that his estranged wife was dead. Could and should. Of course, it was impossible to predict what Phil's reaction might be. Phil wasn't himself these days. He might lash out. He might even kill the bearer of bad tidings. But would that be so awful? Suicides might go to hell and dine on hot coals for eternity, but murder victims, Andy was quite sure, went to heaven and ate roast beef and peach cobbler at the Lord's table for all eternity. With their loved ones. 15. In spite of the nap she'd had earlier in the day, Julia was more tired than ever in her life, or so it felt. And unless she took Rosie up on her offer, she had nowhere to go. Except her car, of course. She went back to it, unclipped Horace's leash so he could jump onto the passenger seat, and then sat behind the wheel trying to think. She liked Rosie Twitchell just fine, but Rosie would want to rehash the entire long and harrowing day. And she'd want to know what, if anything, was to be done about Dale Barbara. She would look to Julia for ideas, and Julia had none. Meanwhile, Horace was staring at her, asking with his cocked ears and bright eyes what came next. He made her think of the woman who had lost her dog, Piper Libby. Piper would take her in and give her a bed without talking her ear off. And after a night's sleep, Julia might be able to think again, even plan a little. She started the Prius and drove up to the Congo church. But the parsonage was dark and a note was tacked to the door. Julia pulled the tack, took the note back to the car, and read it by the dome light. I have gone to the hospital. There has been a shooting there. Julia started to make the keening noise again, and when Horace began to whine as if trying to harmonize, she made herself stop. She put the Prius in reverse, then put it back in park long enough to return the note to where she had found it, in case some other parishioner with the weight of the world on his shoulders, or hers, might come by looking for the mill's remaining spiritual advisor. So now where? Rosie's, after all? But Rosie might already have turned in. The hospital? Julia would have forced herself to go there in spite of her shock and her weariness if it had served a purpose. But now there was no newspaper in which to report whatever had happened, and without that, no reason to expose herself to fresh horrors. She backed out of the driveway and turned up Town Common Hill with no idea where she was going until she came to Prestille Street. 3 minutes later, she was parking in Andrea Grinnell's driveway. Yet this house was also dark. There was no answer to her soft knocks. Having no way of knowing that Andrea was in her bed upstairs, deeply asleep for the first time since dumping her pills, Julia assumed she had either gone to her brother Dougie's house or was spending the night with a friend. Meanwhile, Horace was sitting on the welcome mat, looking up at her, waiting for her to take charge, as she had always done. But Julia was too hollowed out to take charge and too tired to go further. She was more than half convinced that she would drive the Prius off the road and kill them both if she tried going anywhere. What she kept thinking about wasn't the burning building where her life had been stored, but of how Colonel Cox had looked when she'd asked him if they had been abandoned. Negative, he'd said, absolutely not, but he hadn't quite been able to look at her while he said it. There was a lawn glider on the porch. If necessary, she could curl up there, but maybe... She tried the door and found it unlocked. She hesitated. Horace did not. Secure in the belief that he was welcome everywhere, he went inside immediately. Julia followed on the other end of the leash, thinking, "My dog is now making the decisions. This is what it's come to." "Andrea?" she called softly. Andy, are you here? It's Julia. Upstairs, lying on her back and snoring like a truck driver at the end of a four-day run, only one part of Andrea stirred, her left foot, which hadn't yet given up its withdrawal-induced jerking and tapping. It was gloomy in the living room, but not entirely dark. Andy had left a battery-powered lamp on in the kitchen, and there was a smell. The windows were open, but with no breeze, the odor of vomit hadn't entirely vented. Had someone told her that Andrea was ill? With the flu, maybe? Maybe it is the flu, but it could just as easily be withdrawal if she ran out of the pills she takes. Either way, sickness was sickness, and sick people usually didn't want to be alone, which meant the house was empty. And she was so tired. Across the room was a nice, long couch, and it called to her. If Andy came in tomorrow and found Julia there, she'd understand.